Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Here's a question for the beginning of August. Who should be able to access a public beach? Well, in theory, everyone, of course. But if a public beach is hard to get to, except for a select group of people who live nearby, then that public beach begins to seem a lot more like a private one. And in that case, should everyone's taxpayer dollars go toward maintaining it? These are the sorts of questions at the heart of opposition toward a new federal resiliency project to extend the boardwalk at Rockaway Beach from where it ends now at 126th to 149th Street through the wealthier communities of Neponset and Bell Harbor. The city says the new project will protect the area from storm surges and make the beach more accessible to people using strollers or wheelchairs by adding ADA-approved ramps. But residents living in the affected neighborhoods are organizing to oppose the project, citing concerns about boardwalk culture and loss of privacy. They're threatening to sue to keep their portion of the Rockaways in effect private. With me now is Julianne Cuba, reporter for Streets Blog. Her piece on this is called Residents of Rockaway's Enclave Oppose Better Access to Their Semi-Private Public Beach. Julianne, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Can you describe in a little more detail what the city and the Army Corps of Engineers plan to build and why now?
Sure. So it's a $250 million project to extend the boardwalk, as you said, from 126th to 149th. It's actually wouldn't be the width of the current boardwalk that exists now. It would be 5 feet wide, which is what some residents are citing as their concerns. And it would also include zigzagging ramps that would take beachgoers from the street down to the actual beach.
Why does the boardwalk currently stop where it does if there's a public beach beyond it?
So that portion of the beach was actually privately owned, not part of the city jurisdiction up until the mid-1900s, and it was acquired in parcels through the early 1900s to the mid-1900s. And according to an article dating back to that time, the residents did not want to pay for it. They allegedly wanted the boardwalk, but they didn't want to have to pay for it. They wanted the city to pay for it themselves. And then after Sandy, when it was acquired by the city, the Parks Department said that there was some local opposition to extend the boardwalk through 149th, where Jacob Reef starts.
So the neighborhoods of Bell Harbor and Neponset have an average median household income, I see, of over $100,000, more than twice the rest of the communities that line the boardwalk. How much has their relative wealth played a role politically, their power, in keeping them from having a boardwalk up until now?
Well, I think it's, what we see in the rest of the city. It's people who are showing up to community boards who have the ear of our elected officials and have the time to, organize and oppose projects, whether that's like hiring an attorney to suss out their options or just being able to oppose it and have the power of being able to stop a project.
According to the Rockaway Rave, 84% of more than 1,000 Bell Harbor residents surveyed said they were completely opposed to the construction of the walkway. So it sounds like fierce and widespread opposition there. And some of the residents you talked to who oppose the project say they didn't want the boardwalk because they didn't want, quote, boardwalk culture coming into their neighborhoods. Can you translate boardwalk culture? Are you taking that as a racial thing or just a rowdiness thing? How do you understand that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely a dog whistle for, racial undertones. I think the, as you said, the residents of those communities are wealthier, mostly white communities, as compared to the rest of the boardwalk, which is more diverse. So, the rest of the boardwalk has music, people walking, playing, like eating. There's a lot of concession stands, whereas now in Bell Harbor and Neponset, there is none of that. It's like, in essence, private. I was out there last week, and it's definitely quieter. So I do think that it is a dog whistle for.
Here's a caller who used to live in the Rockaways, Ron in Manhattan. Ron, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Hi. I couldn't agree more with the whole dog whistle racism thing. The other thing I think that should be pointed out is the snob parking regulations that say you cannot park on the streets in Bell Harbor and the Neponset from May until September, which clearly is, again, a way of keeping the riffraff out, because we don't want to have brown people or other people on our beaches. It's just so obvious. That's one of the reasons I moved away.
From May to September, it's alternate side of the street, private beach parking. And you write about the difficulty in getting to that part of the Rockaways public beach, even if you have a car, in your article, right, Julianne?
Yeah. So, there is bus accessibility and the ferry to take people there, but there is no street parking during summer of the weekends, which is, I think, something that dates back to the 1950s, and the origins of which are not exactly clear.
More on the parking policy, I think, from Adam in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hi, Adam.
Hi. I think I wanted to make the same point that your last caller made. I was talking to your screener at the time, but it's about the parking policy, which seems to be ridiculous. Again, there's that, no summer weekend parking. And also all the roads to the beach are technically fire lanes at all times. Again, I think that is a questionable, public safety policy. And it's more of, again, keeping certain people out. And it's been that way as long as I can remember. The boardwalk, aside, there's other more obvious longstanding policies in the city that are in place there that do just this.
Adam, thank you very much. So, Julianne, despite not being accessible to the rest of New York City, what does the city pay for in terms of maintaining this area of what is technically public beach?
So if once the walkway is constructed, the Parks Department will be in charge of providing maintenance to it. And it does provide the lifeguards that are there now. And I think just general parks cleanup and the movie mats. But the federal government will pay for the actual construction.
So in our last minute, what happens next? I see the Bell Harbor Homeowners Association, along with other members of the community, may sue to stop the project. Is that where the next round plays out in court?
I don't know if there is any precedent for a project such as this being stopped by a community. The former president that I spoke to did say that they were considering doing that. I guess we will see.
We will have to leave it there with Julianne Cuba, reporter for Streets Blog. Her piece on this is called Residents of Rockaway's Enclave Oppose Better Access to Their Semi-Private Public Beach. Julianne, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Brian. Before you bring a nigga in, know his blood type. What's your
blood type? Time again for StoryCorps. During World War II, Dr. Charles Drew helped figure out how to get blood to injured soldiers on the battlefield. His research paved the way for today's blood banks. His daughter, Dr. Charlene Drew Jarvis, came to StoryCorps with her son, Ernest, to remember their father and grandfather.
He is referred to as the father of blood banking, but during the Second World War, the Red Cross denied the right of African Americans to give blood, which meant that Dr. Drew couldn't himself have been a donor. When they changed that policy, it led to the segregation of blood. but he said there is no scientific reason. And further than that, he said, you need the blood. We are at war. I think Dr. Drew would call himself a determined teacher and surgeon. And if that took taking a stand, that's what he did.
When you were a kid growing up, how much did you know about the work that your father was doing?
I must say that I didn't know a lot about what my father was doing until he died. I was 8 years old, and my mother felt that it was better that we not be at the service. So I was at school that day. When the funeral procession left, it went by my school, and I saw the cars going by. And the cars went by, and they went by. And I was simply astounded that there were so many people who revered him. When he died, he was 45 years old. And it is an enormous thing to think about even now, to have done so much in such a little bit of time. You know, I think I call him Dr. Drew because it is honorific. A man of the ages is not someone who's called Daddy. And that drive for excellence was something that all of us felt, whether it was his children, whether it was a nurse, whether it was the physicians in the hospital.
You know, Mom, I will carry these conversations on to my children, who will then carry these conversations on to theirs. They will all know that Dr. Drew blazed a path for them.
That's Ernest and Charlene Drew Jarvis. Her father, Dr. Charles Drew, died in 1950, the same year the Red Cross overturned their policy of segregating blood. Their interview is archived in the Library of Congress.
The gay rights movement is changing everything.
One of the big stories in the music industry right now has been the response to hip-hop star DaBaby's homophobic comments, which he made during a festival in Miami late last month. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, the fallout was swift as multiple festivals canceled his shows.
With his millions of followers on social media, DaBaby has a powerful platform. He's won BET Awards and been nominated for Grammys.
I'm one of the greatest, ain't no debating on it. I'm still levitated, I'm heavily medicated. Ironic, I gave him love and they end up hating on me.
That's DaBaby on a Dua Lipa song that's in the top 10 of the Billboard's Hot 100 chart. During his concert at the Rolling Loud Festival in Miami, he told the audience to put your cell phone light up if you didn't show up with HIV/AIDS.
You didn't show up today with HIV/AIDS, any of them deadly sexual transmitted diseases that'll make you die in 2-3 weeks, put a cell phone light up.
The backlash was immediate. Dua Lipa distanced herself from DaBaby. Lollapalooza removed him from the lineup. Then more festivals canceled his shows. Elton John and Madonna railed against the misinformation in his comments about HIV.
I think there's a new moment. There's definitely a new moment.
DaBaby is a big star, and Brown University professor Tricia Rose says the cost to his career is significant. At the same time, she says the music industry has long tolerated and profited from artists like DaBaby.
There's many, many artists who are promoted by the industry, who are celebrated by the industry because of their quote-unquote edgy, extreme behavior. And, you know, that is a longstanding pattern that has not abated in any way. And then, you know, when they step out of line about when and how they actually live into that identity, then there's all this sort of, you know, we're all about peace, love, and happiness.
Since the uproar, DaBaby has tried to be about peace and understanding. In his second apology, he writes, "Social media moves so fast that people want to demolish you before you have a chance to grow, educate, and learn from your mistakes." Kevin Powell says he's right. Powell has written extensively about hip-hop and toxic masculinity in American culture.
I believe in cancel culture, not cancel culture. Do we just want to keep canceling people because of their racism, their sexism, their homophobia, transphobia? Or do we actually want to educate people so we become a more educated populace so this does not become a normalized thing where we're constantly just responding to people who are saying crazy, racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic things?
What do you think the consequences for DaBaby's career will be?
Well, he has to be serious. No matter who you are, you have to be serious about making amends. You have to become an advocate for women and girls. You have to become an advocate against homophobia and transphobia. You have to be an outspoken critic of sexism. You have to make amends by your actions, your deeds. It can't just be an apology just because you're trying to save your career, no matter who you are.
Cultural attitudes about sexuality and pop music are changing. Right now, the openly gay rapper Lil Nas X has two hit songs, and he's on magazine covers. Both Powell and Trisha Rose think that's great, but they also say the work towards a more inclusive music industry is far from over. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is facing an impeachment inquiry and now, as announced this week, a criminal complaint based on allegations of sexual harassment from 11 women. The state's investigation into Cuomo's behavior has also entangled one of his former advisors, the president of the influential LGBTQ rights group Human Rights Campaign, who denies any wrongdoing. NPR investigative correspondent Tom Dreisbach reports.
Not that long ago, Alfonso David, the president of the Human Rights Campaign, was singing the praises of his former boss.
It is my pleasure to introduce the state's greatest advocate for the LGBTQ community and my dear friend, Andrew Cuomo.
That was February 2020. Now, since the investigation into sexual harassment by New York's attorney general, both Cuomo and David have faced demands that they resign. Cuomo from the governorship, and David from his prominent role at the largest LGBTQ advocacy group in the country. Both are refusing to step down. Here's where Alfonso David fits into that investigation. Back when David worked as a legal advisor for Cuomo in 2018, he compiled confidential personnel files on a state employee named Lindsay Boylan. Boylan was having a conflict with coworkers not related to sexual harassment, and she decided to resign. Later, in 2020, Boylan went public with an explosive allegation. She tweeted that Cuomo had sexually harassed her. At one point, she said Cuomo kissed her without her consent. Another time, he suggested they should play strip poker. Cuomo denies this. Ann Clark worked on the attorney general's investigation, and she says at that moment, Cuomo's team scrambled.
A team of senior staffers, former staffers, and outside confidants with no official title or role mobilized to attack and try to neutralize Ms. Boylan by sharing disparaging information with the press.
By this time, David had left his government job. He'd become president of Human Rights Campaign. But the report says he had kept some of Lindsay Boylan's confidential personnel records. And it says, when asked, David sent them to Cuomo's team, and that team leaked Boylan's records to the media. The report says Cuomo and his advisors also drafted a letter attacking Boylan. David did not sign that letter, and it was never sent, but the report says he did help gather signatures. Lindsay Boylan's attorney, Jill Basinger, told me she was surprised by just how many people in and out of government were allegedly involved in this effort.
It's really horrifying to think of the amount of power that was put together to attack Lindsay.
The report says that Alfonso David was also part of discussions about surreptitiously recording another woman who accused Cuomo of acting inappropriately. Remember, all of this allegedly happened while David was leading the Human Rights Campaign. David has denied all wrongdoing. He said he was legally required to share those records with Cuomo's team and that he was unaware of sexual harassment claims at the time. Now David is himself calling for Cuomo to resign, but says he plans to stay put. Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel says that's a problem. She's a Democrat and openly gay, and she says she will no longer accept any support from HRC while David is president.
I just don't see how I can be consistent with my personal values and continue to be affiliated with this organization as long as Mr. David remains president.
Do you think he should resign?
Absolutely, yes.
Charles Moran is with the conservative LGBTQ group Log Cabin Republicans, and he agrees.
I mean, it really is a level of hypocrisy that you can't get away from and really diminishes what should be the important work of an organization like that.
Lindsay Boylan's attorney told me she is now planning a lawsuit against Cuomo for illegal retaliation. And when I asked if Boylan might also sue Alfonso David, she said nothing is off the table. Human Rights Campaign did not respond to our requests for comment. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
Let's take a moment now to focus on one of the central players in the controversy embroiling New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, New York Attorney General Letitia James. It is the report she dropped this week detailing multiple allegations of sexual harassment and assault against Cuomo, her report that has drawn mounting calls for his resignation, including from President Biden. Now Democratic leaders in the New York State Legislature are considering impeachment proceedings. Well, Letitia James has made a long career of taking on powerful people and powerful companies, and we're going to talk about that career with Bloomberg News legal reporter Eric Larson, who has profiled her. Eric Larson, welcome.
Thank you.
So, a detail I learned from you, part of what makes this latest chapter in her career so interesting is that she's a former ally of Governor Cuomo's. Is that right? What's their relationship?
Yeah, that's correct. You know, a lot of folks have said that having his endorsement when she ran for attorney general was, of course, crucial to giving her that, extra boost of legitimacy that she needed for such a big statewide role. Having previously been a public advocate for the city of New York and on New York City Council, and before that, a public defender. So going to this huge statewide role of attorney general, it clearly was a big help to get Cuomo's endorsement in that.
Yeah. I want to just fill in a little bit more of that background. She is in her early 60s. She is the first Black woman to win statewide office in New York. And you write about her decision to run for attorney general and that it was prompted by a chance encounter at a coffee shop. What happened?
Yeah, when I interviewed her for the profile, I asked her why she decided to run for attorney general. And she said that she had a chance encounter with someone at a coffee shop, someone that she knew in the neighborhood in Brooklyn. This woman was an undocumented immigrant, and she was explaining that her husband was facing deportation. And the AG says that that was when, she really decided that she wanted to do something to make a difference when there was so much going on in the area of immigration nationally, and the state attorneys general were deeply involved in challenging the Trump administration on that.
Hmm. Fascinating. The list of adversaries who she has chosen to take on through her career, it is not short. We would be here all day if we went through all of them.
All right.
But suffice to say, these are not lightweight adversaries. The National Rifle Association, Google, Facebook. I mean, just talk us through a few of the career highlights that leap out to you.
Right. In the role of New York Attorney General is a very high profile role to begin with. So, when she took this job, she already had so many lawsuits pending of challenging various parts of the Trump administration's policies, but she still found time to join with other state AGs and file these big antitrust lawsuits against Facebook and Google. And of course, the suit against the National Rifle Association, trying to dissolve it, accusing it of defrauding its own members. And it just really fit with her long career of fighting on behalf of the little people, so we could say.
She's also had some big losses. I'm thinking of the 2018 lawsuit against ExxonMobil. That comes to mind.
Yeah, that was a big loss for her. I covered that trial. When the suit was filed, she wasn't yet attorney general, but she did oversee the team that ran the trial. It was a novel case. She was accusing Exxon of ripping off investors through some accounting shenanigans, basically. But the judge threw it out. They didn't appeal. It was sort of a big loss for the state. And also, of course, the Facebook lawsuit has been dismissed by a judge, and the states are appealing that decision. So it remains to be seen what will happen with that.
It sounds like she's got plenty to keep her busy, but I gather there is some speculation that in a twist, she might have her eye on Governor Cuomo's job, that if he were to be impeached, she might throw her hat in the ring. Has she said whether she'll run?
I have asked her that on more than one occasion, and she does not say no. She says, basically, she's not going to say this early what she's going to do, and she wants to really focus on those cases, winning these lawsuits, and isn't going to be distracted by talk for running for governor.
Sounds like you will have no shortage of stories to keep you busy as you keep tracking Letitia James's career. That is Eric Larson, legal reporter for Bloomberg News. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
It's up to you, New York.
In New York City, if you want to go to a gym, restaurant, or concert hall, you'll need to prove you've had at least one shot of the coronavirus vaccine. That goes for customers and workers. New York is the first city to pass such a sweeping vaccine requirement. It starts to phase in this month and goes into full effect in mid-September. Here to talk about this decision is New York City Health Commissioner Dr. Dave Chokshi. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you so much for having me.
The city has described this as an effort to keep public spaces safe. At the same time, Mayor Bill de Blasio today framed the new policy this way.
If you're vaccinated, all that's going to open up to you. You'll have the key. You can open the door. But if you're unvaccinated, unfortunately, you will not be able to participate in many things. That's the point we're trying to get across.
So how much of this decision is about making life difficult for unvaccinated people and pushing them to get the shot?
The core of this is about health and safety, but it's about a belief that to bring New York City back, we have to get New York City vaxxed. And that means making sure that the spaces, you know, the settings that people are in are increasingly places where people can rely on others being vaccinated so that everyone is safer.
The city reports that about 3/4 of adults have had at least one shot, which is required to get into these places. We've heard from people who have not been vaccinated that in many cases, they're concerned they can't get time off work to recover from possible side effects, or they don't have transportation to a vaccination site. Is the city combining this new requirement with outreach and incentives?
Absolutely. And this has been our commitment over the last several months of our vaccination campaign. We've been working on further lowering barriers to access, making sure that we're rolling out incentives. And only after we have taken those steps are we turning to these stricter requirements to push the vaccination levels even higher. I'll give you a couple of examples with respect to what we've done to improve access. First of all, virtually everyone in New York City now lives just a few blocks away from a vaccination site, whether it's a city site or a pharmacy or a doctor's office. But we've also brought mobile options into people's neighborhoods, and our in-home vaccination program is available where we will actually come to people's doorstep for anyone who is currently eligible for the vaccine. And last week, the mayor announced a $100 incentive for anyone who gets the shot. And we've already seen a good uptake based on that.
How is verification going to work at all these different businesses?
This is an important question. And, you know, some of this is parts of the program that we'll have to work out in collaboration with the different venues that are part of the requirement. But at the end of the day, our principle is simple. We want people to have multiple avenues, but a common destination. The multiple avenues for verification could be the city app that we have. There's a state app called the Excelsior Pass, or you can just bring in your paper CDC card. Any of those would be accepted. But the most important thing is that you're able to show proof of vaccination, and that's what keeps everyone safer.
You know, this pandemic has been so hard on businesses. What would you say to a small business owner, an independent restaurant owner who says, look, I should be able to decide whether or not to require my customers to be vaccinated, and this new policy is going to hurt my business?
I do understand that. And there has been, so much economic devastation along with, the suffering to people's health that has been experienced over the last few months. But I would turn it on its head to say that this is actually the key to ensuring that not just that people are protected, but also that our economy comes back as well. We have seen how fundamental public health is to the economy, but we have to lead with these public health efforts. I also think about some of my own patients, who are restaurant workers or, ushers in a concert venue. And from the sake, from the perspective of their safety, this is also a very important step.
That's Dr. Dave Chokshi, New York City's public health commissioner. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you again for having me.
10 things to know before you go to Boston.
Boston Acting Mayor Kim Cheney says her city will not follow New York City in creating a vaccination passport. New York officials say proof of a COVID vaccine will be needed for indoor restaurants, theaters, gyms, and more. For more on her decision, we're joined now by Kim Cheney. Good morning, Mayor, and thanks very much for speaking to WBUR's Morning Edition.
Good morning, Bob.
So tell us about your reasoning behind your decision.
Well, let me begin by being very clear. The COVID-19 vaccine is our top priority. It is the central focus to ensuring that our residents are protected from COVID. That is why I have invested $3 million in a vaccine equity grant, and why we continue to work on making sure that every resident in Boston has access and opportunity to get the life-saving vaccine. We also know that requiring a passport, if you will, would have a disproportionate impact on poor communities of color. And so rather than going that route, our strategy is to continue to inform and educate and work with community partners who have trusted relationships on the ground, meeting people where they are so that we can get the life-saving vaccine into people's arms.
Let me ask, there are some restaurants and bars that are going to require proof of vaccination, not to mention employers requiring people get vaccinated. Are you comfortable with that? Do you support that idea?
Well, as mayor of Boston, I am leading by example. We are working with our workforce. I am meeting constantly with our cabinet chiefs and department heads, with our labor unions, with employees around working toward a vaccine mandate for us as city employees. So either folks will choose and get vaccinated, or they will have regular testing. We want to see everyone vaccinated. That is the goal. But we do know that there'll be disproportionate impact overall in public spaces. For example, there are still folks who are not even eligible. Our youngest children are not even eligible for the vaccine. And so we don't want to bar them from libraries and things of that sort or restaurants. We want to make sure that we are working with our workforce, with our business leaders, with everyone to get the vaccine in people's arms.
So let me be clear about this. You have said that you're leaning toward requiring city workers to get vaccinated or be tested regularly. Have you made a decision on that?
We are working toward that actively right now. We are working with our labor leaders, with our legal department, to make sure that either vaccines or testing is part of our protocol in the city of Boston for city employees. It is very important that we protect our workforce and thereby protect the general public. And as it relates to the general public, we continue to work on getting more and more residents vaccinated. Again, the vaccine is our best hope at beating the pandemic. The Delta variant is very contagious. It spreads very easily. And we don't want to see COVID continue to mutate. So we've got to do all we can to protect our residents, and that is my focus as mayor.
All right. I understand that, but I'm wondering if in the big picture, how do you square all this up? You've said public school students and staff will have to mask up this fall. City workers might have to be vaccinated or tested, but restaurants and other businesses are free to make their own decisions. Some people might say that's confusing and inconsistent. Respond to that.
Well, our focus, again, continues to be getting the vaccine out into people's arms. That is not confusing. That is very clear. The goal is to get Boston residents vaccinated. And so that continues to be our focus. We want to protect our workforce. We are working with our labor unions, with our employees, to make sure that they have every opportunity, whether it be time off, to get the vaccine. Or to have regular testing. And the same is true. We are leading by example, and we hope that the response in the private sector, again, is to get
others vaccinated. And so we are working with a number of partners, whether they be community groups, whether they be business leaders, whether they be faith-based institutions, to make sure that every single resident in Boston can get the life-saving vaccine.
The latest Boston Public Health Commission data show about 61% of city residents are now fully vaccinated. However, that number is just 45% for Black residents and 47% for Latinx residents. And the vaccination rates are even lower in neighborhoods of color. What are you going to do to get those people vaccinated? And are you hopeful that, you know, you can get the city of Boston up to overall up to over 70%, which is where the number is statewide right now?
Yes, I am very hopeful and encouraged. We have seen in the last 2 weeks alone the number of vaccines increase. I think the good news in all of this is that people are taking the Delta variant serious. More and more residents are masking up. More and more residents are taking the opportunity to get vaccinated. We will continue to work with community partners. We will continue to bring mobile vaccination clinics to communities that have been hit hard, particularly communities of color, our younger population, to make sure that they are getting vaccinated. This is the goal. And to your point, if we have large numbers of folks who aren't vaccinated, we don't want to ban them from public spaces or from restaurants. Instead, we want to focus on the life-saving vaccine and getting the vaccine into people's arms. That is our number one priority. That continues to be our goal, to make sure that every resident can be protected.
Okay. Acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey, we're going to leave it there this morning. Thanks very much for speaking to WBUR's Morning Edition.
Thank you, Bob. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
White supremacy is the sickness.
The World Health Organization is calling for a moratorium on COVID booster shots, at least for the next 2 months. The WHO says wealthy nations should not be giving third doses to fully vaccinated residents, while billions of people in lower income countries have not even gotten their first yet. NPR global health correspondent Jason Beaubien joins us now. Jason, a lot of countries are already planning on giving out boosters in the fall, or maybe even starting to do so. So this sounds like a very strong statement by the WHO.
Yeah, you know, I think the WHO is actually getting quite frustrated with what it sees as global inequity in access to vaccines, and many countries not doing anything to try to address that. More than 80% of the doses that have been administered so far in this pandemic have been in high-income and upper-middle-income countries. And in the global scramble to get doses, poor countries really haven't been faring well, and they continue to struggle. You know, if you look at it, you've now got about half the entire U.S. population fully vaccinated. But in the Philippines, it's less than 7%. In Guatemala, it's 2%. Over in Nigeria, it's 1%. The head of the WHO, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, says wealthy nations have essentially been hogging these vaccines, and they shouldn't now start topping up people with booster shots while these low-income countries can't even get their most vulnerable people vaccinated.
We need an urgent reversal from the majority of vaccines going to high-income countries to the majority going to low-income countries.
You know, and this isn't just a global solidarity argument. It's also that from a public health perspective, you have to drive down the levels of the virus everywhere if the world is ever going to finally get this pandemic under control.
On that, what's the outlook right now?
You know, unfortunately, the global outlook on getting this under control isn't good. Worldwide, the number of reported cases just passed 200 million. You know, everyone agrees that that's an undercount of the true number. But more significantly, the number of daily cases continues to go up. For the last 6 weeks, cases numbers up. The case numbers globally have been steadily climbing. Cuba is seeing a big spike. They went from having almost no cases at the beginning of the year. Now they're reporting 8, sometimes 9,000 new cases a day. They even took some hotels in the middle of the country and have turned them into COVID treatment wards. Elsewhere, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, they're all dealing with significant surges. This pandemic ebbs and flows, and countries that a few months ago looked like they had it licked, you know, now they're getting slammed.
I know the U.S. has been offering to send hundreds of millions of vaccine doses all over the world. How much of an impact, if any, of that, is that happening?
You know, it's definitely a step in the right direction. It's absolutely what is needed right now, but it takes time to get those doses out there. Some of them aren't even slated to be delivered until 2022. And while the U.S. is offering up hundreds of millions of doses, the world needs billions right now. So the effort is going to take, other actors, other nations coming in as well. And it's not just vaccine doses. Many countries, they're facing logistical challenges in storing and distributing these complicated medical products.
Are we going to be done with this anytime soon, Jason?
You know, that is the big question. But from a global perspective, the end of this is still nowhere in sight. About 15% of the world is now fully vaccinated. But most of those fully vaccinated people, they're clustered in North America and Europe. The WHO has a goal of getting 10% of every country immunized by the end of September. But they're not really on target even for that relatively modest goal, which means that you've got large parts of the world where the virus can spread, where new variants can emerge. I was talking with Ruth Caron. She's a professor of international health at Johns Hopkins about this.
We know that the Delta variant will spread most quickly, and new variants are most likely to arise in unvaccinated populations. So the more of the world that's unvaccinated, the more we are all at risk.
You know, and that risk is also true in the U.S., where you've got many parts of the country that also have very low vaccination rates.
That's NPR Global Health Correspondent Jason Bobian. And Jason, thanks.
You're welcome.
Medical apartheid, the dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
Briefing this morning, Dr. Page, your boss, acknowledged xenophobia and racism at the meeting. He said that intimidation and anger has to stop. He also asked for more videos. Do you believe there are videos or there is evidence that could come out that would support your position?
It was a reflexive action. It was a momentary loss of composure and control.
Are you worried at this point that this is exactly the distraction that you didn't want? I'm Sarah Fenske. With the Delta variant spreading across Missouri and the U.S., St. Louis County Executive Sam Page issued a new mask mandate last Monday in collaboration with St. Louis Mayor Tashara Jones. Their mandate was ahead of most other government entities in the country, although many have since followed as the CDC altered its guidance to encourage masks even for vaccinated residents in areas with high case counts. But Tuesday brought bitter pushback from the St. Louis County Council. Public Health Director Dr. Faisal Khan ended up in the hot seat and also making national headlines. In a two-page letter to Council Chairwoman Rita Hurd-Days, he said he'd been harassed, quote, shoulder bumped and pushed, and subject to racial slurs by the crowd. And he joins us today to explain what happened and discuss the fallout from his allegations. So, Dr. Faisal Khan, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure, sir.
So many St. Louisans read your letter and were horrified. Let's talk about some of the more incendiary allegations in it. What are some of the remarks you heard while you were making your presentation?
I would rather not repeat that language.
Sure. And I should say, I'd rather not hear that language either. But what was sort of the tenor of what you heard people saying?
It was angry, hateful invectives, and I'm sure it came from a very tiny sliver of the crowd. I have had messages of support and disgust, even from people who were in that crowd that evening, protesting the mask mandate, saying, you know, while we disagree with your approach and we don't want to wear masks, we were appalled at what we saw. So it really was a case of a whole crowd of people whose tempers had been stoked and brought to a frenzy, and, you know, things boiling over into territory that really should not have been breached in the first place.
And you blame Councilman Tim Fitch for that. You say he sort of set the tone there. What do you feel like he did that set, as you say, these couple of individuals over into territory that you found offensive?
It's not even about personalities. And let me say this very clearly. What people might not know is that I have known and had the pleasure of working with Colonel Fitch I instinctively still call him Colonel Vic. When he was police chief, you know, he was just the most friendly, most supportive individual. We worked together on a variety of issues. And this was an unfortunate event in which, you know, regardless of the position you take, regardless of the way you want to vote, et cetera, once the temperature of a crowd of people has been ratcheted up all the way to 100, it's not going to come down to zero just because the deliberative body is ready to move on to the next subject. Mm-hmm. It's going to spill over, and some individuals are going to lose control of their tempers. And, you know, when the evening has been spent vilifying, you know, a public official trying to explain the rationale behind public health policy, things will get said and done that should never have happened. My greatest regret is that the decorum in that almost sacred chamber was allowed to deteriorate to a point that it happened, and it should never have gotten to that point. Much has been made of, you know, one particular council member. That was never my intention. That was never the issue here. I have the utmost respect for Colonel Fitch, regardless of, you know, which side of the policy aisle he may belong to, because as a public official and a public health official, I know he understands that we serve everybody, regardless of their political affiliations or their beliefs about freedom or constitutional amendments, etc. That is never a consideration for us.
So Dr. Khan, I have to say, this is just a very different tone than what's in your letter. I mean, in that tone, you do kind of come after Councilman Tim Fitch. I mean, the only reason I brought him up is he's kind of front and center in this letter. Have you had a bit of a change of heart about the way you called him out in this letter?
I stand by the contents of that letter. What happened on Tuesday night was truly unfortunate. The intentions may not have been malicious, but the way it played out was absolutely unacceptable and disgusting, because this is not the only contentious issue that I'm sure the council will ever have to deal with.
Sure.
Or for which they will have public officials called forth to explain the rationale for a particular decision or approach. And so when things get out of control, bad things are likely to happen. And it had, I am sure, a bone-chilling effect on the multitude of public servants and public officials in St. Louis County, whose job it is to interact with the council and present themselves to explain things.
Dr. Gunn, we've been talking a bit about what happened inside that meeting. I want to talk about your exit from the meeting. This is in that same letter. You said you stand behind that letter. You write, quote, "I tried to leave the chamber, but was confronted by several people who were in the aisle. On more than one occasion, I was shoulder bumped and pushed. As I approached the exit and immediately outside the chambers, I became surrounded by the crowd in close quarters, where members of the crowd yelled at me, calling me," and then you detail a few of these racial slurs. You also describe in the next paragraph, quote, "being physically assaulted." Now, Dr. Khan, there's video of your exit from the room, and I don't see any shoulder bumps or pushes, as you allege in this letter. And the new video emerged last night of your interactions in the hallway, and nothing matches what you describe in this letter. Why is that?
So first, I just want to say that I'm not going to comment on an investigation that is ongoing, but I will stand by what I described in that letter as my experience. And with all due respect to anyone out there, no one walked a mile in my shoes that evening but me. What transpired in a few unfortunate seconds as I exited the chamber left me shaking. It should never have gotten to that point. I completely stand by my assertions. One segment of one video or whatever it may be does not capture my experience that evening.
Were there any friends or supporters who were with you when these alleged physical assaults happened or shoulder bumped and pushing that can speak to that and can back you up on this?
No, it was me, myself, and I thrust into the middle of this situation. I respond to any invitation, any request from the council to present myself and explain policy options. And when I walked into that chamber, on Tuesday evening, there was a capacity crowd. Almost everyone was unmasked. Some individuals had children on their laps, and my heart sank at that sight, thinking, my goodness, this might be a super spreader event in of itself. So, no, it was just me by myself in the middle.
So in his briefing this morning, Dr. Page, your boss, acknowledged xenophobia and racism at the meeting. He said that intimidation and anger has to stop. He also asked for more videos. It sounds like he's looking for evidence that would support this. Do you believe there are videos or there is evidence that could come out that would support your position?
I have no idea, sir. I wasn't paying attention to, you know, who had a cell phone and who didn't, and My emphasis after that jarring experience was to make my way out and just extricate myself and get home. That was it.
So in your exit, as you acknowledge, you did flip off a bystander. Can you tell us what led you to that point? And was this directed at one particular bystander?
You know, I don't even remember that. I remember something being yelled at me that I will find unmentionable, and I instinctively just flipped the middle finger, and it was a reflexive action. It was a momentary loss of composure and control for which my own precocious 15-year-old has admonished me. You know, and I've had time to reflect on that, regrettably.
So, Dr. Khan, when you wrote this letter, you said that you don't regret it because you were faced with the racist vitriol from Councilman Fitch that he'd privately and publicly stoked against you since your appointment. Do you now have some regrets after talking to your teen?
And what I said in the letter was I don't apologize for it. I obviously regret losing my composure. That should not have happened, but it was one of those most human of reflexive actions, I will leave it at that. My own family has admonished me about not answering an insult with an insult and simply choosing to walk away, and I've learned that lesson from it.
Hmm. We got a tweet from Suzanne who writes, with the current divide we're seeing between residents in St. Louis County, how do you think the discovery of the latest video, this is the surveillance that showed you exiting the room, and that video did not show anyone shoulder bumping you, how do you think that will affect that divide? Do you believe that the mistrust that residents will feel after seeing that video will affect your position?
I hope it does not change people's views about the imminent threat posed by the virus. The individual is nothing. First, it is one segment of one video of one area, and I will leave it at that. The investigation will take its own course. I stand by my assertions. But the important thing to remember is that we are here to serve everybody. The virus does not discriminate. It does not believe. It does not care what your political affiliations are, which segment of which video you believe. It is poised to cause misery and death regardless of your political affiliations or belief systems. That is the only focus of our efforts right now.
And you said you were worried going into this meeting that this meeting could become a super spreader event. We now know that someone at that meeting did have COVID-19. The city health department has come forward and said that their contract tracing has revealed that. Does that hit home for you why you believe masks are necessary?
I wish, Sarah, I had the luxury of sitting here and saying, I told you so, as tempted as I was when I found out. But I am filled with sadness and worry at what might happen to the health and well-being of everybody who was there. Our job as public health is to take care of everyone, and this was my greatest worry. As I mentioned, my heart sank a little as I waited for my turn to be called up and looked over the crowd. Everybody was unmasked. Everybody was talking to each other. People were angry. Some had children on their laps. Some were clearly in the older age group. And as an epidemiologist and public health official, that was my greatest fear.
So now you want everyone who attended that meeting, even people who are fully vaccinated, to complete a 14-day quarantine, which would be the next 9 days here. The latest from the CDC, they're not yet saying that vaccinated people have to quarantine unless they have symptoms. Why are you asking that of public officials and other people who were at that meeting to do that quarantine, even if they're vaccinated?
So the lead agency on that is the City of St. Louis Department of Public Health, and Dr. Fred Eccles, the acting health director there, and his team issued those instructions. They deliberately chose to err on the side of caution and go above and beyond just the bare minimum recommendations the CDC puts out. Keep in mind that the CDC's advice is guidelines and broad recommendations. They leave it up to local health officials to determine their particular situation on ground so as not to stymie their efforts. So, you know, I, along with so many others, are quarantining at home, essentially, following the advice provided by the City of St. Louis.
So you're doing this yourself?
I was advised to, along with other individuals, and that's exactly what I'm doing.
Is this in some ways, this advice to stay home, I mean, this kind of keeps us from having a similar thing at the next meeting. This basically guarantees that if you testify again, it has to be virtual. Do you feel more comfortable with that at this point?
The advice put out had nothing to do with, you know, what happens at county council or whether or not somebody shows up, et cetera. My own comfort level leads me to believe that, you know, if I am asked to appear or explain something, I would prefer to do it via a video link, especially during the course of the quarantine period, but perhaps in the afterwards as well. I regret most of all, as I've already said, the loss of decorum and the loss of control within that chamber on Tuesday night. That should never be allowed to happen. We should be able to have a mutually respectful and controlled conversation and an exchange of knowledge rather than an exchange of ignorance. No public servant, no public official who is called upon to testify or explain things should be subjected to any verbal abuse or the kind of invective that I experienced this past Tuesday.
I have to ask, you had had this job previously and you returned to it in the middle of a pandemic, even as there have been all these headlines about public health directors being subject to this kind of abuse. What made you want to come back?
I have questioned my sanity a couple of times on that note, but here is what motivated me. First, public service, in particular public health, is a calling in life. It's not just a job. I moved back to St. Louis, leaving a very lucrative job in the private sector with a much higher monetary compensation because this is a mission in life. It's not a job. And I needed to be in the heat of battle, helping my community as a proud St. Louisan fight this pandemic and to help my colleagues at the Department of Public Health fight this pandemic, period. And I would not do things any differently.
So, Dr. Khan, you're doing that and you're here and you're implementing things like this mask mandate. But now you find yourself caught up. I mean, this letter seems to have set off some events where now there's going to be an investigation. You asked for an investigation into this and people are calling for videos. People are analyzing these videos like the Zapruder film. Are you worried at this point that this is exactly the distraction that you didn't want?
It is unfortunate that, you know, the back and forth nonsense that we seem to have inculcated and incorporated into our national discourse is likely to cause some degree of distraction. That was never my intention. I was asking that the events of Tuesday evening be examined and investigated so that it never happens again. And two, that the loss of decorum and control never happen again, period. The part about, you know, being distracted is something that is very real. And my intention is to keep my team and my focus, frankly, firmly on fighting the pandemic. Things will, with the investigation, will take their own time and in their own course. To everybody listening, our message is please set that aside, because guess what? The virus is not going to wait for any investigation to be completed. It continues to infect people in the St. Louis region. It continues to create the potential for more misery and more death. That is what our focus needs to be on.
Well, Dr. Faisal Khan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sarah. As always, it's a pleasure.
Drink, 85 cents. You pay or go.
What's a phi? I don't understand a phi. There's a V in the word. It's five. You don't got V's in China?
Not Chinese. I'm Korean.
Whatever. You come to my country, you take my money, you don't even have the grace to learn how to speak my language. You're Korean.
Huh?
You have any idea how much money my country has given your country?
How much?
I don't know. It's got to be a lot. You can bet on that.
You go now. No trouble.
I stay. What do you think of that?
Well, one place where there are a lot of armchair doctors and scientists is in the County of Orange. Since the beginning of the pandemic, OC supervisors have been getting an earful from folks railing against masks and vaccines. But last week, things got really ugly, with awful racist comments even being thrown at the board's chair, Andrew Doe. A warning, this soundbite is offensive.
Mr. Doe, going on in your country right now in Vietnam is 4,000 little kids who are in quarantine camps away from their parents because of this fake scamdemic. And you come to my country and you act like one of these communist parasites, I ask you to go the f*** back to Vietnam.
Yeah. Wow!
Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record.
All right.
I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay.
Give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
Mr. Doe, going on in your country right now in Vietnam is 4,000 little kids who are in quarantine camps away from their parents because of this fake scamdemic. And you come to my country and you act like one of these communist parasites, I ask you to go the fuck back to Vietnam. Yeah!
Lord, now it seems like the board has had enough and is limiting public comments. LA Times commentator, columnist Gustavo Arellano's here. He's here every week with the Orange County Line, and he joins us right now. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
Good Lord. All right, it's one thing to question the science behind COVID vaccines and mask wearing, but what that guy said in public on video is just deplorable. And the crowd, that's the shocking part about it, is the crowd actually cheered. Is more of this kind of, you know, xenophobia, racism, is that being thrown around maybe also at other Asian American public officials in Orange County? It does have a large Vietnamese population, after all.
Yeah, first and foremost, of course, this is Orange County, California. This is a place where xenophobia is part of the county religion one way or another. And of course, we're in the wake of anti-Asian violence and just rhetoric against all Asian Americans in the United States because of this whole COVID thing that's happening. But what the word said to Chairman Doe, who's the chair of the Board of Supervisors, is pretty unprecedented, especially in the past couple of decades, as Vietnamese have actually joined the Republican Party, as they've become party brokers, so to speak, and won elections. I can't remember something this noxious said against even Vietnamese in public, geez, since the 1980s, really, back when they were still, a lot of them were coming in as refugees.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like Doe is a liberal Democrat pushing for, you know, all kinds of mask mandates. He's a pretty conservative Republican, right?
Yeah, he's actually been pretty good on this COVID, on the Orange County's response to COVID. A lot of people say he could have been better. I personally think he could have been better as well. But he's not as bad as, say, his colleague, Don Wagner, or their former colleague, Michelle Steele, who's now a congresswoman in Orange County. So if you're not that criticism is ever particularly warranted, like that noxiousness, but if you're going to go against, I'm assuming the person who said that, well, who knows what that person, who I'm not going to make any assumptions about him except the first three letters of that word.
What has been the response there in Orange County to these kinds of attacks? And why do people think that they're happening now? Or maybe this has always gone on?
Well, what's going on in Orange County Board of Supervisors? You have this very active contingent of people exercising their First Amendment rights, yes, but being complete boors about it, being jerks, and just getting more and more noxious and more just out there. Like, again, criticizing Chairman Doe, oh, your country. No, Chairman Doe's country is the United States. And if this guy who, by the way, named himself after a fictional character, so that's all you have to know about who that person is. If he actually paid attention to Doe, he'd realize, like, you know, Doe has been an upstanding citizen of the United States for a long time. So, of course, there's been a lot of criticism. Also, you're getting now strange bedfellows where you're getting liberal Asian American politicians say, yeah, I actually have never agreed with Andrew Doe on anything, but definitely for this, I'm going to stand in solidarity with him and say racism is just, it's always unacceptable, but especially when you're trying to do your job as a public official to protect the public.
Now the supervisors are being criticized for limiting public comment periods. In what way?
First and foremost, can you blame them on one hand because of this? Though it is a First Amendment right, no one should be subject to abuse like that. But what's been going on is now that the Board of Supervisors is meeting in person, allowing people from the public to also go in there, like, no more, we've had enough. And the only person who's saying, like, no, we should allow this to happen is the newest supervisor, Katrina Foley. And she tried to bring it up, and ironically enough, Chairman Doe shut her down.
What's been the response from other supervisors? They're all on board with this limitation?
They voted for it. They haven't said anything to the media. Supervisor Foley points out that other cities like Santa in Orange County, they still allow this form of public comment. For me, it's like, hey, look, it's a public comment. And you're going to say, oh, well, at what point do we stop? And do we start allowing Facebook comments or whatnot? But I think, you know, when you go to the Board of Supervisors meeting, you have to fill out a form. You can't just stand up and yell. You'll be escorted out. So you fill out the form. The way I see is if you submit these emails, you should read them. Why not? There is no, there's no hurt in that. And if they're noxious and whatnot, then so be it.
How are other cities in the OC handling this, Gustavo?
Yeah, again, like in Santana, they're still allowing it because let's not forget, as your previous guest just mentioned, we're in the midst of a rise in the Delta variant, and especially when you get these people who go to the Board of Supervisors meetings without masks, railing against scandemics, plandemics, and whatnot. You really think a good citizen is going to want to be in that pit of pathogens, possibly? Oh, wow, that's a lot of alliteration. Sorry.
Alliteration from anxious anchors. Seeking powerful
exactly. All right.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist of the LA Times, here every week with KCRW's Orange County Line. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
The Turner Diaries. It sold over 500,000 copies. Who do you think is buying it? Eric Rudolph, the Olympic bomber. Wade Page, who shut up the Sikh temple. Larry Ford, developing typhoid and cholera. William Krar with the cyanide bomb. Anthrax, ricin, botulism, C4, IEDs. I could go on like this for hours, and all of them are white supremacists.
El Paso is remembering the 23 people killed during a mass shooting at a Walmart on this day 2 years ago. The alleged gunman drove 10 hours from the Dallas area to the border city, saying in a post online that he wanted to stop the, quote, Hispanic invasion of the state. KTEP's Angela Cocherga reports on concern that conditions in Texas are ripe for more violent hate crimes.
Water gently cascades from two fountains at El Paso's new Healing Garden, where 23 Italian cypress trees represent each of the victims of the mass shooting.
Every tree was planted by one of the family members.
El Paso County Judge Ricardo Samaniego, the top locally elected leader, walks me through the garden. A former psychologist, Samaniego's been involved in all the painstaking details, including the shape of the garden.
Circular, so that it would be like a hug.
He hopes this place will help visitors find the strength to move forward.
It's a place that reminds you, you know, they should never die in vain. What is it that I could do to make things more transformational?
Action and results.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott promised change immediately after the 2019 mass shooting. He convened a series of roundtable meetings of the Texas Safety Commission to tackle several critical issues.
They include combating threats of domestic terrorism. They include rooting out hateful ideologies. And they include keeping guns out of the hands of deranged individuals, while at the very same time making sure that we can do so in a way that safeguards Second Amendment rights.
Since then, Texas has expanded gun rights, allowing people in the state to carry handguns without a permit. The governor's office declined an interview request, citing his busy schedule. El Paso Congresswoman Veronica Escobar, a Democrat, says the governor failed to lead following the mass shooting.
Not only has he not done anything, but we've gone in the opposite direction, the more dangerous direction, on so many fronts.
And there's messaging from Republican state leaders. At a recent news conference where Governor Abbott announced he plans to build a Texas border wall, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick said this.
We are being invaded. That term has been used in the past, but it's never been more true.
That's the exact term used by the alleged El Paso Walmart gunman. Domestic terrorism and hate-fueled violence is on the rise, according to the FBI. Congresswoman Escobar says she's seen the consequences firsthand.
In El Paso, during the August 3rd domestic terrorist attack, and being literally inside the Capitol as terrorists surrounded us on January 6th, there is absolutely a through line there.
El Paso County Judge Ricardo Samaniego also sees similarities in the angry mob that descended on the Capitol and the lone gunman who drove to El Paso.
They pick up the narrative. They think they're going to defend the country in that particular way with anger and, you know, ugliness as a way to solve I don't know what.
Adria Gonzalez survived the wrath of the Walmart gunman. She was inside the store shopping with her mother during the attack. She fears it can happen again.
It could be that it can be repeated, but that's why we can't forget. We can't forget that morning. We can't forget those 23 victims.
As El Paso remembers, there's a renewed call to action across the country to prevent other cities from experiencing the same heartache and hate crime violence. For NPR News, I'm Angela Cochergan, El Paso.
The man knot. Race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
In June, New York City's Board of Corrections announced it will end the practice of solitary confinement beginning this fall. The announcement was made just days after the sixth anniversary of Kalief Browder's death. The New York City teen spent 3 years inside Rikers, two of those in solitary confinement, without being convicted of a crime. Browder subsequently struggled with his mental health and eventually took his own life. A new exhibition in Brooklyn, New York, seeks to shed light on Browder's story. NewsHour Weekend's Yvette Feliciano spoke with artist Kobe Kennedy about his exhibit.
In his piece, Kalief Browder, The Box, at Brooklyn, New York's Pioneer Works, artist Kobe Kennedy created an 8x10x6 feet sculpture that replicates the exact dimensions of a solitary confinement cell on New York City's Rikers Island. The glass surfaces are etched with line renderings of the bed, barred window, and toilet, along with text.
Sandblasted on the side of the piece here is Kalief Browder was kidnapped off the street by police, taken away from his mother, family, friends, held for over 1,000 days on Rikers Island for a crime he did not commit, and was physically and mentally tortured by being locked in a solitary box for over 700 of those days, 23 hours a day.
When Kennedy first learned about Browder's story through news reports, he says he felt incapacitated for days.
It hit me so hard because I feel a real personal connection to it, because what he made it through and what he endured has been one of my worst nightmares ever since I was a child. And to be held in that way, you know, you're kidnapped.
In addition to his time in solitary, Browder was physically and mentally abused by prison guards and other incarcerated people.
You talk about this chronic fear of having a situation like that from the time you were, you know, a child. Where does that stem from?
For me, I've experienced, whether it was growing up in D.C. as a kid or living my life in New York, honestly, every country I've been to, you know, I've experienced these moments where I've come very, very close to having that freedom taken away. A lot of times just for being who I am. And I knew going into this that the piece itself, being a recreation of a solitary confinement cell, could be triggering for people. But then on the flip side, there are vast, vast amounts of communities and people that need to see this and need to experience this.
To that end, the installation is presented in conjunction with a four-part town hall series led by the civic engagement organization Four Freedoms. It introduces participants to the damaging impacts of mass incarceration. Discussions center the voices of legal scholars, activists, and formerly incarcerated people at the forefront of the movement to end solitary confinement.
I'm standing in front of you as somebody telling me I suffered the inhumanity, the indignity, the trauma, and the torture of solitary confinement. Nobody should be treated like that, not any single human being.
Sam Giratani of Negative Space, a social justice consulting company, facilitated the collaboration between Kennedy, Pioneer Works, and Four Freedoms.
Because it's a show around mass incarceration, there's sort of like a small sect of people that will continue to come and see shows like this. But because this is happening at Pioneer Works, I'm hoping that we just reach a little bit more of a broader audience. Even if it's not completely changing a mindset, it's at least educating people on the HALT solitary movement and what they're doing to change policies.
What is it that you feel like the other side or people from this subjective reality that's so different from yours, you know, what are they missing about Khalif's story?
They don't realize that they would offer him plea bargains all the time while he was locked up, and he wouldn't take them. He was out for 2 years. After he was released, fighting for his case against the city. Not just that, but fighting against the realities of the institutions that were still coming down on him, still trying to paint him as a criminal.
Browder's trauma caused lasting depression that resulted in his suicide in 2015, about 2 years after his release. But it's Browder's strength in solitary confinement and his perseverance that Kennedy wants the public to remember him for.
It's the story of a boy finding so much fortitude and so much strength within himself that no matter what came at him, he always fought back against it in defense of his own humanity and his own truth. And the most important part on this piece is the quote that Sam blasted here. The way I looked at it, if I got to stay here just to prove that I'm innocent, then so be it. That's by Khalif himself.
Browder's family settled a lawsuit with the city of New York in 2019, yet no one was held accountable for having incarcerated the 16-year-old for 3 years with neither trial nor proof. Kennedy hopes the sculpture will illuminate the HALT solitary movement and Browder's overwhelming endurance inside the box.
A lot of people miss that in the whole story, is Khalif's strength, you know, his fortitude, just nonstop, even all the way up to the last part of his life.
If you or someone you know is in crisis, immediate support is available 24 hours a day through the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255.
I want to be a cop.
We start tonight, though, with a story our ABC 15 investigators broke.
A woman found dead near Camelback Mountain was hiking with a Phoenix cop. And tonight we know the woman's name is Angela Tremonti, a 31-year-old visiting from Boston. She was found dead Friday after separating from that cop to turn back down the mountain in the summer heat.
Tonight, our Dave Biskobing learning more about the officer. He joins us now with all the details.
During hours of searching Friday in triple-digit heat on Camelback Mountain, Phoenix fire officials gave this initial report.
So the heat, we're being told that she's from Boston and that they arrived here yesterday afternoon. This is her first full day. She's never been here before.
But he's from the Phoenix area.
Yeah, he is from here. He is originally from another country. He's been living here for a while, he said, and he's very familiar with this mountain. Says he hikes it at this time of day all the time from the top to the bottom.
What fire didn't know then and we know now, that man is Officer Dario Dizdar. He's a 14-year member of the Phoenix Police Department. He met Angela Tremonti online. They had been chatting for a couple of months. She flew out to meet him in person for the first time, arriving Thursday afternoon. but she would be found dead less than 24 hours later. Here's a timeline. Dizdar and Tremonte went hiking in the mid-morning. Between approximately 10:30 and 11 a.m., the two split.
Halfway up, she becomes overheated, wants to turn around. He tells her to turn around, go back down to the parking lot. He continues up to the peak, makes his way up to the top, comes all the way back down to the parking lot. She's not here.
At 1 p.m., Dizdar calls 911. Around 5, her body is found.
You know, you never leave someone behind.
ABC 15 spoke to a group of Tremonte's friends in Massachusetts about her sudden death.
She gets overheated and they agree to let her go down and he continues up. I mean, what do you guys think about that?
It's disgusting for us, for him to have allowed that. How do you not accompany somebody down when they're having a very hard time up the mountain when she's exhausted? How do you have no disregard for somebody else's safety, especially when you're a police officer?
These women say Tremonte was kind, strong, confident, also very fit and exercised regularly. Fire officials say Tremonte was found already dead in the backyard of a house along the mountain.
So at this time, unfortunately, it is now a death investigation, so I can't get too far into the weeds of exactly how we found her and where we found her, but I could tell you it was very close to the mountain, and it did appear as if she was trying to alert somebody at a nearby home.
ABC 15 spoke to a witness who saw the pair hiking, and he provided this photo. Here in the distance, you can see Dizdar and Tremonte. Now, this was taken at 10:36 a.m., and it may show when the two start to split in opposite directions.
We just want answers, and it doesn't add up, and we really want to know why, you know, even if this was heat exhaustion or whatever the case may be, why would he allow her?
Why did you leave her alone?
I'm Investigator Dave Biskobing, ABC 15, Arizona.
Phoenix police didn't directly respond to our questions. This afternoon, the department did release a statement. It confirms one of their officers went hiking with Tremonte, but neither brought water on the hike. The statement also said at this time, there is no evidence to indicate foul play.
This is dedicated to who it may concern.
A family's suspicion was right all along. Their loved one did not die by suicide. That initial cause of death by the Madison County Sheriff's Office was overturned after an inquest this morning. Good evening, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I'm Michelle Lee.
And I'm Casey Nolan. The case of Durante Martin has left the family furious with the local sheriff's office. They tell the I-Team's Christine Byers they finally have hope that the suspect will now be caught.
It took a jury of six about 2 hours to determine Durante Martin's death was no suicide.
I feel rejoiced. I am so glad. I am happy that they seen through all their lies and they saw the truth that my baby did not kill itself.
The prosecutor, coroner, and investigators involved in this proceeding wouldn't go on camera, but the Madison County prosecutor told the I-Team he asks for coroner's inquests when there are questions about how someone died. It's a proceeding that happens in counties that don't have medical examiners. There's no question Durante Martin died from a gunshot wound to his left temple, but the jurors in this case, which included one black man, one white man, and four white women, had to determine today how it happened. Was it by suicide? Was it by accident? Was it natural causes? Or by violence? A total of 26 witnesses were called, including James Wade, who owns the home where the shooting happened. Durante was there for Wade's daughter's 18th birthday party. Jurors also heard from paramedics, highway patrol investigators, and Madison County deputies. Troopers and the county's pathologist said they believed it was a suicide.
Justice for Durante Martin!
As a handful of people gathered with Durante's mother and grandmother outside the courthouse, they still believe Durante's death may have been racially motivated.
We don't have the answers to who did it. We don't have the answers to why they did it. But one thing for sure and two things for certain, God ain't through yet.
The verdict means the investigation is not over. With enough evidence, prosecutors could still charge someone in Durante's death.
I think it's a start, but
there's a lot further we have to go with this. We got to figure out what really happened, why it happened.
In Fredericktown for the I-Team, Christine Byers, 5 on your side.
Despite the jury's decision, investigators say the homeowner where the shooting happened passed a polygraph. He testified he didn't know who shot Martin. They also still believe Martin died of a gunshot wound, and a forensic pathologist agreed.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, August 7, 2021. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, questions, counter-racist suggestions to offer. The number is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Many things to share. I'll try and be brief so we can get to the callers. Wowie. 2001, worst year ever. I feel like I said that last year. Did say that last year, and it has just continued. I will say, this year, I have never felt a more consistent, like daily, sometimes hourly, personal danger throughout a calendar year than I have. And I mean, this year is almost over. It's almost September. But it has been absolutely menacing this year. In fact, I've been telling folks, I've never had a year where I've had to call enforcement officers so many times. I lost track, in fact, of how many times I've had to call enforcement officials. I think I wrote on social media earlier, I said, thus far, I've only had to call the enforcement officers twice this week, which is a marked improvement. Like, wow, maybe next week we can just do one time next week and we'll see what happens. In fact, I even had to call the police one time this week, not even because I personally was being attacked, although I was right there. So I was going to the store, almost specific locate myself in Seattle. So I'm going to the grocery store, Green Lake. I think just earlier that day, I had heard a Seattle non-white person, city employee, he described this area of Seattle, Green Lake, as Disneyland metaphor. I love the Green Lake area, one of my favorite places in Seattle. So I'm going to the grocery store. We're about two blocks, maybe pretty close, max maybe I think three blocks from the grocery store. And this black female driving the bus, she stops. There's a crosswalk, lots of crosswalks in Seattle, right? She's driving the bus and there's a white man. He's not on the bus. He's outside. He just starts yelling, "Nigger, nigger." And he's like kicking and stomping and kicking at the glass on the bus. So he jumps around in front of the bus so she can't take off. She's not going to run over him, unfortunately. Then he goes around to the driver's side and he's like punching through the window and trying to yank it open so he can assault her. She's having to actively, aggressively like fight to try to keep the window closed and the whole "nigger," rah, rah, just total rage terrorist attack. I'm stunned. Like I said, I'm three blocks from the store. That's what I'm thinking, like, oh, I wonder if I'm going to the store. And so this just right in front of me. This happens. Like I said, the bus had stopped because it was at the crosswalk, and this guy just leaped from the sidewalk and this attack ensues. So I whip out my phone and call to report it to the police. I think they say attacking a transit authority, that's like a felony, serious crime. So I reported to the police, and this is like total act of white terrorism, calling her a nigger and everything else, and, you know, disgusting. But that's been 2021, like everyday imminent danger. Man, I would totally hide if I could and say, you know, we'll try it again in 2022 maybe, see if it's any safer, give it 3-4 months or so. Anywho, let's see. Next, I can't even emphasize enough the personal danger. So they had a report in the Seattle Times local newspaper yesterday. The report reads, make sure I get it because I posted it online. I always have been saying Seattle best plantation and all the rest. This is one of the most embarrassing, talk about disgusting, reports that I've seen in some time. Front page, amid violence at Seattle courthouse, sheriff orders staff to work remotely. Not because of the Rona, not because of masking disputes and we don't have enough vaccines to share. We have to work remotely because of safety concerns. So we get to the specific details, the nature of the safety concerns. They write about the courthouse, which is in the downtown Seattle area. This region was never Shangri-La, said Andrea R. Vitalich, a senior deputy attorney with the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office. But over the last couple of years, things took a hard dive from gritty to downright dangerous, said Vitalich. The attempted rape of a woman inside a courthouse bathroom last week was the final straw, metaphor, she said, after years of escalating assaults on courthouse employees, jurors, witnesses, and others. And I said, now, that should be an immediate disqualification for best plantation. If things are so bad, the King County Courthouse has become no man's land. Staff can't even work here safely. Got to stay at home. Total embarrassment. Like, the and I just had to go to the King County Courthouse, get my protective order filed. I was just there. I didn't have a sense of menace at every turn greater than my normal sense of, I'm downtown, keep my head on a swivel. I had to pass City Hall to get to the courthouse, and City Hall is closed for, I guess, the Rona, or maybe they're raping people in the bathroom there as well. But I never feel safe downtown. I didn't know that things were that bad at the King County Courthouse, but I literally was just in that building in the library days ago. Menace. Danger, absolutely, at every turn. Next, extensive list of notes. Okay. From some of the audio clips that we heard, they started with the beach. I thought that was important. They were talking about dog whistle politics with the beach in New York, where this so-called semi-private beach, they don't want the riffraff and the beach culture to come in and make all this noise and hoopla and the rest of it. We've had whole programs about denying black people access to the beach waterfront properties. N.D.B. Connolly, black male. Andrew Carl, suspected racist, 2015. They were both on the program, discussed that. And I was contrasting, even with all the personal danger and horror of this year, that has been one thing that has been so helpful. I've been to so many beaches, even went to the beach on Thursday for the book club. Next, so they had the segment talking about the punishment of DaBaby, saying that he made some sort of homophobic remarks. Once again, we have the homophobic black male making some sort of no-count remarks about the LGBTQI community, and he's been resolutely punished, canceled all of these venues, and we're going to hold them accountable. I said, there it is. Now, when we start holding white people accountable for the practice of white supremacy racism, we'll be making some progress. But thus far, it's just we hold niggers accountable for their perceived misdeeds, like DaBaby. And then I even paused for Welsing moment, not the man. No. DaBaby. Not men and women. Certainly not universal man. DaBaby. Right. And then they bring Kevin Powell on victim of white supremacy, black male, but he was on MTV and the 40 years. MTV just had their 40-year anniversary. That's crazy. Kevin Powell, a big part of the MTV experience. But they bring this victim of racism on. So we got to address racism and sexism and homophobia and conflation. VGQ, but I mean, it's victims guaranteed qualified, but it's very easy to have non-white people who are confused about what white supremacy racism is. No, there is no, we got to address all the isms. And let's see. And then right with that, what I did, I deliberately, so I played that first. And then we heard the segment where they talked about Governor Cuomo. Now they want to go after his Negro henchmen. They talked about Alphonso David, who is a black male. And he was, they say, the head of this LGBTQ organization that helped Governor Cuomo cover up all of his sexual misconduct as governor of New York and harassing all of these female staff members and some of them non-staff members. And we want him to step down, too. And I said, wow, this is the exact, once again, no count black males, the black male privilege. But I said, this is just like with the Coon man. Governor Northam in Virginia might be a 2024 hopeful when he was, all the scandal came out and the photographs, were you the Klansman? Were you in blackface back in your days in med school in Virginia? It shifted from him to Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, black male. And, you did some sexual misconduct and we think you might have raped a female or did something else inappropriate. He may have, I don't know, but he's steadfastly, resolutely denied, said absolutely not. He hasn't been charged. Presumption of innocence, right? Constitution says something about that. Anyway, but that's, he's the one that's still facing those allegations now. Coon man, chilling. Still governor, Commonwealth, making decisions about the Rona as a doctor, med school. They don't even bring up, what were you doing in med school again? The comparison, though, you see that they just racist man, racist woman, racist child. They do some of the same things from Virginia to New York, not that far. Next, the Dr. Faisal Khan. Wow. Even before I get there, because they got Lil Nas X, they think racist man, racist woman. They have a comprehensive package. They cover all areas. So within all this, people were just talking about, oh, wow, they had heavily promoted Lil Nas X and all of the sexual incorrect behavior, anti-sex. So we got the black male promoted here, what they call the poster child metaphor for incorrect anti-sexual behavior. And then we come back the other way, both sides of the coin, as they say, the other metaphor. We come back and we go, DaBaby, no count black male, homophobe. Dr. Welsing would say A pluses. So then we got Dr. Faisal Khan. So this is St. Louis. This is Michael Brown Jr.'s St. Louis with Dr. Faisal Khan, where they have him on St. Louis Public Radio with Sarah Fenske, white woman suspected racist. That interview, rewind and listen to it again. White woman Sarah Fenske, St. Louis Public Radio. The only reason that 2021 I listen to St. Louis Public Radio every week is because of Michael Brown Jr. 2014, I was listening to it every day. Heard Sarah Fenske way back when. So that report, Dr. Faisal Khan, victim of white supremacy. He comes on to talk about masks. And it's been tons of these type of incidents where a non-white person who's an official and they come out to give some sort of caution and recommendation about what should be done. And shut up, nigger. Shut up, sand nigger. And all the rest of it. Wow. Just everything about it. One of the most important lessons, you as a non-white person, he is a non-white, non-black person, but non-white. You cannot prove racism. She says, hey, we don't have any evidence. We don't have any video. We don't have any other witnesses to come here and stand and say, yes, you got shoulder bumped and somebody said this to you and you were terrorized. You're just making it all up. Do you have any video? Do you have any testimony? You think there are any other witnesses? Did you hear the tone that she took? Presumption that you are lying. You're making this all up. Don't you think this is going to make it more difficult since the video came out and it doesn't support what you said, that it's going to make it more difficult for you as an official, for people to have trust in your message? Are you serious? Do what? Whatever little snippet that they got, that's the totality of what happened. If it's not there, it didn't happen. Wow, it was amazing. The entire segment. Then she comes back and she says, hey, you said in your letter that you didn't have any regrets. And now you come back and you say that you talked to your teenage child. And he said, you know, you shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't respond to an insult with an insult. Now you're contradicting it. Don't you have regrets? And he said, whoa, whoa, whoa. Words are important. He said, what I said in the letter that I stand by is I do not apologize and I don't stand on your square metaphor. That's what they say. He said, that's different than I regret that all of this happened, which he said repeatedly. The total absence of decorum. And I think a lot of that because it's been non-white people like, oh, yeah, decorum. What do you mean? We just showed you that for 8 years you can have a nigger president and decorum. So they terrorize Dr. Faisal Khan in St. Louis and get Sarah Fenske, suspected race soldier, to come on and, no, this didn't happen. You know this didn't happen. Are you making this up? You didn't. He has to be grilled, metaphor, questioned with all of that. Do they do that? You all can compare. Do they do that when they have a white person on and he's been accused or she's been accused of racism or some other form of misconduct? Do they get questioned in that manner? So we heard Sarah Fenske, and then we go from Michael Brown Jr.'s St. Louis all the way to California, Orange County. Again, the documentary Black in Orange County, long history of this part of California. We read about them in Geronimo Pratt, Last Man Standing 2. We get all the way out there, and it's the exact same behavior. Dr. Doe, I believe, non-white male, so-called Asian. Did you hear in the same, and it wasn't just for you to come over here and promote this scandemic and people in Vietnam, for you to come over to my country and try to promote this scam. Why don't you just go back to where the bleep you came from? It is the eruption from the crowd. This is not one lone crank with no teeth. And he's just an ignorant old white man. This is just one of the old Donald Trumpers that's 90 years old. Incidentally, he didn't sound that old, but whatever. This is just one of the old white people that we need to die off. Oh, no, no. This young fella, this whippersnapper, he expresses his view and then it's thunderous applause. Really? I thought we just did Juneteenth and did all that talking about, you know, we're against bias and diversity and include. That doesn't sound like diversity and inclusion. Go back to your country. Like, whoa, same thing. Now, would they have behaved in that manner if this wasn't Dr. Doe, if this was some white person, an individual, male or female, classified as white? Now, I will pause. They did, you know, allegedly plot to kidnap and execute the governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmore. So, you know, that did happen. That notwithstanding, I'm not sure their conduct would have been the same if this were a white person that they were speaking to. And I want to be real specific, even in both of these incidents, they used the language of offensive. They didn't say racist. In fact, the segment from California, KCRW, the presenter, when he talked about it, he said, Lord, might be offensive. And then they play the audio and the crowd cheers, and he comes, good Lord. Even that is odd. Now, I might use that sort of phrasing, but most of the time on like NPR and when it's a white person on some of these mainstream outlets, they do not invoke the Lord as some sort of mild expletive goodness or something like that. But they will not say, Lord, what does that even mean? Why not just identify it as what it is? An act of racism, as opposed to this is offensive. That is one of the largest acts of racism right there, consistently with the use of words that it's offensive. This just hurts your feelings. You're a little child and you're just sensitive and you get offended so easily, as opposed to no, this is an act of white supremacy racism. They even had that. They had a major report for journalists and saying, call things by their proper name. Yes, you can brand things as racism. If someone calls you a nigger, we don't have to say that, ooh, we don't know what to call this. It's an act of racism. Yes, call things by their proper name. It's never. Offensive is not the correct use of language. Racist white people, they know the value of calling something offensive as opposed to this was an act of white supremacy. Next. Oh my God. Even with Sarah Fenske, she says she was so degrading in talking to Dr. Faisal Khan, this non-white male. This is going back to St. Louis. She says they're requesting that people send in if they have recording or video on their phone, like it's the Zapruder film. For people who are not old enough, that's the footage of the JFK assassination that was captured, like trying to compare this to the assassination of a president. Although any act of white supremacy serious, white supremacy should be taken seriously. She's not doing that at all, even with them. That's why I say the metaphors. How are we talking about this? Are we talking? Are we acting as though this is something serious? Or are we totally setting, I'll use the metaphor, setting the tone, because that metaphor was used in the segment. Are we using language that will make people think, man, I think he's making this up. I don't believe this guy. There's no video. He doesn't have any proof. There are no witnesses. He's just out here throwing conspiracy theories, because that's the way they talk about the JFK assassination. He's just making up some old lame conspiracy about what they did. Let's see. Oh, and in the segment in California, just the language, they say offensive. And the other one, they said things got ugly. Metaphors, words are important. I don't even know what that means. Are you talking about a person that's not attractive? Or are you talking about white people practicing white supremacy? That's not getting ugly. That is white supremacy racism. Call things what they are. Again, you can compare. Do you hear people talk about, man, things got ugly during the 1930s in Nazi Germany? Did they say that? I don't hear people say that. That's another minimizing. Let's see. The segment with Angela Tremonti, victim of white supremacy. She goes on a hike with this victim. Incidentally, social media safety. Like, man, I know we've been cooped up and haven't had an opportunity to get out as much, restricted activities, but that does not mean just go outside and cut a fool and, you know, throw caution to the wind. Metaphor, be reckless with conduct. Like, maybe if you haven't met this person, they're just on social media, let's do something public with a lot of people. Let's go to the local shopping mall, you know, something like that. Let's not go out in the woods where won't be a whole lot of eyes to see what might transpire, that sort of thing. Let's stay somewhere where there's security nearby. Might be able to get to a friend or a pal in need if it seems like something might not be right with this fella. Just my thoughts about safety, social media safety, we'll call it. Anyway, one important tidbit. You heard in that segment that they said that Officer Dizdar, I believe that's how they pronounced his name, a suspected race soldier, they said that he told them that he was familiar with Camelback Mountain, that he hiked it on a regular basis. They just had a report that came out today from the Arizona area that, hey, he told other people that he had never hiked Camelback before. He didn't know anything about the area. So at minimum, now we seem to have contradictions in your statements with a suspicious death. That is important. And they said that apparently this officer has a history of lying. I guess if I remember Officer Bentley, Bryant S. Bentley, who was with us before, who said, hey, enforcement officers are trained to lie. Social media safety. Last portion that I'll get, the segment on Durante Martin. One, I saw a report where they referred to this as the tragic death of a black man. I said, whoa, Durante Martin was 19 at the time of his suspicious death, we'll call it. And the pictures, the bulk of them that I have seen, seem to show him in a high school football uniform. Why are we, I know, you know, generally if it's a Tamir Rice or Trayvon Martin, if it's a black male and they're 12, 13 years old, maybe even 9, we want to charge them as an adult, Khalif Browder. I understand that. And I mean, 19, hey, by law, you are no longer a child. But I mean, I think one of the terms they use sometimes will be a teenager. unless I'm a total idiot, I think 19, it's almost in the word, 19. I said it there twice. I think 19, you still qualify as a teenager. I think that's the, because I mean, at 19, you can't even, oh, I don't know, legally purchase alcohol. Few other important tidbits where you're not quite totally responsible. I mean, yeah, you're technically grown, but you're not that grown at 19. Why not just a black teen? No. Black man, not that we care. The man, not that we care about them either. Anyway, but Durante Martin, this was another where I pause, where they give the lame argument for black male privilege as though everybody in the U.S. knew about Durante Martin. Everybody heard about this, right? All of the black people who Black Lives Matter and talk about racism and read, white fragility. Timothy Wise, Jane Elliott, we're serious. We talk about racism and white privilege all the time. We all knew about Durante Martin, right? You all have been seeing and using hashtags Durante Martin, also in Michael Brown Jr.'s Missouri. But everybody knew about that case, right? I mean, this is a black teen who had his brains blown out at 19 under suspicious circumstances with white friends. Everybody's heard about this case, right? It couldn't be that we missed this totally in the era of Black Lives Matter and George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, that this wasn't even worthy of mention in Michael Brown Jr.'s Missouri. Black male privilege, indeed. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. DeKalb's listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think DeKalb's is constructive. Visit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button in the top right corner. You can also support via Cash App. The link cash.app/$DeKalb's. Much obliged to all the folks who have supported 12 plus years. Hopefully we are worthy of your time and energy. You can also support via our wish list at Amazon.com under Gus T. Renegade. Much obliged to all the folks who have nabbed an item or three. Hopefully we have offered a few constructive suggestions and been more accurate than not about what it means to be classified as white, what white supremacy racism is, and what we can do to solve this problem immediately. Let's see. We'll get to the first few folks who dialed in. No metaphors. We had lots of them throughout. They were talking about some of the different, meetings where people got upset about the COVID-19 situation. They said things were allowed to boil over. I don't know what that means. You already heard things were allowed to get ugly. People couldn't control their tempers. I think that's a metaphor, too. I don't know what that means. Again, I think people can conduct themselves appropriately, individuals classified as white. Decorum tends to be lessened if we're dealing with niggers, non-white people. If we could refrain from using metaphors, that would be appreciated. Making every effort to be precise, exact with our commentary words are very important. Race soldiers use metaphors, analogies to practice deception and to confound us. Many times, non-white people, we are still learning and we don't have logic to articulate our views. So we'll substitute an analogy, comparison of some sort. We'll prompt about those. Let's precisely select our words. You can take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, commentary. That would be grand, just to make sure everyone has at least one opportunity to share. If you have additional thoughts, observations, once everyone has spoken at least one time, feel free to add any additional questions or suggestions. For Neutralizing Workplace Racism, Vegan RD, she dialed or wrote in, and she wanted to know, for her job, she was requested to give a lecture about 45 minutes on nutrition obesity, correct eating. She would not be compensated financially, but she would get library access, Yale library access, and she'd be able to add this to her resume. And she wanted to know, do you think this is something she should do? Would you take it, even though you're not going to get coin per se, but you will get the library access? You can add this to your resume. Would you do this? You can share just so we can see if we can get some additional feedback for her on that one as well. Let's see. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up. If you have commentary, questions, thoughts, line should be open. Feel free. Folks are taking their few moments to get their thoughts or observations together. Broadcast the game, not for spectators, and particularly with all of the things that are happening abroad and the audio segments. Certainly there would be lots of things to process, ponder, even just what is happening in your particular region with the COVID-19 situation. That in and of itself, if folks are just dialing in to spectate, hopefully we can wrap things up super, super quickly. Not for spectators, none of these broadcasts, but particularly not the compensatory call-in, not neutralizing workplace racism either. Let's see.
Can I be heard?
Non-Clemson grad, yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Non-Clemson grad here, of course. Yeah, I definitely had a couple of things to say about some of the stories that were played earlier in the broadcast. The one about the baby was very interesting in particular. The one about him, you know, he said something at one of his performances, and now everyone seems to be mad and seems to think that he was just out there trying to, you know, talk badly about people who are LGBTQ. I find that one particularly interesting because, for example, I have a friend here where I live, my wife, and he's gay, you know, he's married, him and his husband. We find them to be very, very good friends. We hang out with them often. They teach dances like we do. But something interesting happened with my friend recently. He had an unfortunate lesson with what it means to be white. He was trying to move into a new place that would have been from where he's currently teaching. And the place he was looking to move into, it's been, vacant for like the last 3 or 4 years. And then all of a sudden, the person who owns the building, a white person, I assume, all of a sudden makes a deal with another person to go into that space. And, you know, leaving us wondering, like, okay, you haven't had someone in this space for about 3 or 4 years. All of a sudden you, and I'm talking about moving in here, and all of a sudden you found someone to go into my place. We talk about, you know, me moving in within the next couple of, I think half a year or so. So interesting, we were, you know, having to deal with white people when trying to move into new businesses to rent for his business. But what I was telling him about this kind of thing, you know, all the stuff that keeps happening around him. So, for example, one of his dancers, a white female, she's acting up in a way where she started to take some of her the business's old videos to use a to create her for herself, like what would be an audition reel, you know, of her doing of her dancing inside the business. And the way she went about it was that she was using some of the business's old videos and stuff, and of course upset our friend who was a gay black male, and basically using the business's resources to potentially leave the business while using some of the business's resources and videos and stuff. And he's still dealing with that. He hasn't responded to her last communication, just trying to think about how to, you know, respond to her. And to me, with all the stuff that keeps happening around him, I keep telling him that one of the reasons why you keep thinking, you know, sorry, why things keep happening around you is because, you know, when you do find yourself in the company of white people where they invite you to stuff. Like, for example, he was invited to judge a drag queen show a couple of weeks ago. You keep thinking that these people like you because, you know, you're gay. And I keep telling you, no, they invite you because they use your gayness as a wedge So when that they do something, whatever it might be in the immediate future, they can say that they're not racist because they know you or you associate with them. And if you want to associate with these people, it's perfectly fine to associate these people. But make sure that you're getting something out of the relationship as well, too, as opposed to, they have you do something. And then when you want something or need something, you're unable to ask for help or get something that you need. You know, for example, there was a white gay male who came into town a little over a half year ago who was teaching a couple of classes outside of my friend's studio. And he was very disrespectful to not just the studio owner, my friend, but also my wife, Missy. And even with all that disrespect, after teaching like one class, he ended not just the class, but the series of classes that the white man had, a white gay male had planned for the rest of the inside the studio. But nevertheless, this same white male was able to go to a different part of town. I think he was born here. But, he moved to, New York City. But, right now it's closed down because of COVID, so he's forced to move back to the area and work. And my friend, who's having a hard time filling up his classes, is unfortunately not shocked to find that this other gay white male is able to fill up his classes in a different side of town, charge way more money, and get all the resources and help. And I juxtaposed that to my friend, who basically does the same thing. And just because you're gay, just like the other, you're a gay black male, doesn't mean you have you're gonna get help from the gay community or anything like that. Unlike the gay white male who is very disrespectful and seems to only get rewarded when he wants to do something. Let's see. I also add to this, a couple of weeks ago, I was out at an event for a black woman who was an elected official in our region who's been on the city council for 40 years. And while at this event, there were many other politicians from the region and even outside the region. And I ended up taking meeting a person, a white male, who was running for governor of the state. And while he's shaking my hand, a random person takes my picture, and I say, "Hey, why are you taking our picture for?" And it turns out the person was a campaign manager for the white male running for governor of the state. And I asked them to delete the picture because I don't want my image being used. I just met this person. I don't know his policies. And I would hate to see my picture end up on somewhere like Facebook or something, where it gives the impression that I support the white male running for governor just because I took a picture shaking his hand. And of course, I use this as another example to my friend, as a gay black male, sometimes they just use you for your image or your presence to give the impression of inclusivity. And, when it's time for you to get resources and stuff, do you benefit the way they benefit from you when they use your presence? And then aside from that, because this whole DaBaby situation is so ridiculously ridiculous, obviously we have a black man, Mr. Alfonso David, defending the current New York City governor, Andrew Cuomo. Now, I don't know whether or not Andrew Cuomo did what he did, but I do find it interesting that when a white man gets accused of doing something potentially really, really incorrect, like, sexual assault or rape or abuse or retaliation, that they get a gay black male to defend him. And that's what I mean by, I don't know what with Mr. David Alfonso, maybe they're friends, maybe they're not, with the governor of New York. But what does it look like when a black male, gay or not, finds himself in a situation where he's the one defending the governor who's accused of all these different types of potential crimes? And it almost looks like the black male, just because he's gay or whatever his situation is now associated with the governor for those crimes, but they're talking about more so the black male and their relationship more so than the governor himself. At least that's what it's gonna, I feel like it's gonna turn to pretty soon. And you know why I think it's very important. I keep telling my friend this, like, you know, if you're gay, that's fine, but be careful who you associate with, because when something hits the fan, somehow you're gonna be the one to catch the blowback. And with that, I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, non-Clemson grad. Safe travels to Miss C. Neutralizing workplace racism. Fridays, 8 p.m. Eastern, previously mentioned. 5 p.m. Pacific. I'm not surprised at all. The difference in opportunities for the white instructors, female or male, any of their conduct, really. Them being able to fill up their studios, get lots of students, despite all of the challenges that are being presented right now, and charge more money and get a great location and all the resources. That is what it means to be classified as white, and that is the networking. In fact, that is the appropriate use of the term community. That's what it looks like when you have a community. It becomes much more easy to do those type of things. And then, exactly as he said, what does it mean to be white? Hey, I come, I work at the studio, hang out here for a little while, and then I just take whatever resources I can for my own personal aggrandizement, and then, you know, ditch you all and move on to my own personal project. Probably do the same thing. I can move across town, make more money, and, you know, just put that in my resume. Oh, well, yeah, I'm not, of course I'm not a racist. I worked with the black people over here and show all the pictures. Look at my video. See there? Just stole, didn't even ask permission. Can I use some of the clips to help get my portfolio together? Nah. What does it mean to be white? Excellent advice for your homie, your friend, as you said, to just be cautious about the way white people can use your image, likeness. That's the whole NCAA court case that they just had. And just being able to say, well, this black person, we had him here for XYZ and this number of dates. And of course, we're not racist. What do you mean? He's been here, you know, bunches of, look at all the pictures that we have. Or the governor, the fellow who's running for governor, to be able to come through to, hey, look at me. This guy's valedictorian. See there? I love black people. He thinks I'm going to win. He came up, wanted to shake my hand like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I don't even know this guy. I don't know his platform. Like, what are you doing? Sneaking pictures because he's reaching out to the Negroes of South Carolina. He's no pitchfork Ben Tillman. Look at this. Slick. That's master deceivers. But excellent recommendation to your friend. All you can do, the metaphor they say is plant seeds, is offer constructive, logical advice. And, you know, maybe people can think about it. They might have to come back to it later, revisit after some things have happened. Like, that non-Clemson grad was trying to share something with me. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in. Hits the fan is a metaphor. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up. If you have commentary to share, line should be open.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I wanted to start out with the segment. I think that was in Orange County. I think the California area on the West Coast. I definitely understand why you did that, the rewind, so the guy can repeat it again, saying, go back to where you come from, Vietnam, and the support. And it sounded like it was a group of people. Like, I couldn't see it, like the visual, but just from the audio, definitely sounded like a lot of support. Like, it was synchronized with the clapping and the yelling and everything. And then I thought about where, I guess that was the person classified as non-white Asian speaking in a portion of the segment, and he was mentioning the anti-Asian, attacks or, you know, whatever the term that was used. And I thought, like, didn't they just do, like, pass, like, a hate crime bill? And I'm thinking, like, what's the criteria for someone to be charged with that? Like, if it involves some kind of language like that, that meet the criteria? Just asking, I guess, hypothetically. because it seemed to be a lot, or it looked like it was a lot of support for that hostility, white supremacy toward that non-white person. My next one is the, I think they were over in Boston. I think I was the mayor, and they were talking about the vaccinations. And that came up again about the racial classifications of, well, the people of color, and are they going to get vaccinated and their percentages of this and that? And I'm thinking, I don't know if they mentioned white. Maybe I missed that part of it, but I usually don't hear them mention white people's vaccination percentages or whatnot. And I continue to look at that pattern or listen for it. And there was a news story of a white man, a racist terrorist, on what they call on the airplane. I guess they call it unruly. That's the word they'll use, unruly passenger. And I noticed the bulk of the example they show on video tend to be pale white people, white men. They had to tape this guy to the seat, right? And this dude was saying, you know, something like, my father has $2 million and is very arrogant. To be expected, arrogance and entitlement. So, yeah, they ended up taping this guy to the seat. So I think white supremacy dominated in that instance. The governor said something I saw on Friday, yesterday, talking about the reason why the Florida cases are going up, or the term spiking, quote unquote, are going up or increasing, is because migrants. He said migrants, that word. Now, I was wondering, what does he mean by that? Because people go or come here on vacation for different reasons, and they have these what they call super spreader events. But what does that mean by migrants? You know, and then on, in another instance, he's saying to the president, Biden, that, hey, you need to just, you need to, until you get the border straightened out, don't say nothing to me, or something, like, very defiant. So I just pieced those two instances together. And I thought, could he be mentioning race, you know, on racism? And I suspect he's a white supremacist, but I think racism is possibly involved in that type of speech, you know, that kind of language. And my last one I wanted to mention is, I agree, like, with the St. Louis area, the non-white person on the non-black category, I think, was, as he said, his experience. He was pushed, you know, assaulted, racism was practiced, name-calling. And the line of questioning, like, that, she did that like a racist expert. I guess I'll just say that, because it looks like she has that area of a profession, news media. She's used to asking questions. So I think she did that to definitely try to agitate, practice racism. Let's see if I can get an emotion out of you so I can make a report maybe in the next day or two, say, hey, he just got so emotional. Like, and I don't know what kind of language they may use as journalists. I just think that's a skilled way to practice white supremacy. And she seemed to, I guess I'll say, keep her composure in a sense, but it looked like she had some hostility too, in my opinion. But they know how to hide it in a sense and not show it openly while speaking to a non-white person. And I agree, they would not question a white person that many times. Like, if I answered your question already about, hey, well, there doesn't seem to be video footage, and then after that, two questions later, you seem to ask the same type of thing in a different way, worded differently. I think she was definitely trying to agitate and get the guy emotional, but I think he responded professionally, and he did a good job to me. And that's all I have to share. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Much obliged, caller in Florida, Dr. Faisal Khan in Michael Brown Jr.'s St. Louis. I thought he did a fantastic job. He kept his composure, like he didn't let her, Sarah Fenske, this white woman, he didn't let her get him upset and rowdy. He calmly answered his questions and repeated himself when he needed to. I thought he did a great job, but I agree completely. I thought that was excellent illustration. White woman, suspected race soldier. And like I said, even the metaphor when she was talking about, you know, you got people requesting that they send in videos like this is the Zapruder film or something. Like, even a metaphor like that, I felt, is like the veiled contempt. I don't think she would have questioned a white person like that. It wouldn't have been like this is some sinister international plot to assassinate. No, just can you send in videos? So there is an investigation, he said. Let's find out what happened. That would be it. It wouldn't be all this, oh my gosh, and we're making much ado about nothing, and you're lying about all this, and you're just emotional, and some colored person who gets easily offended, and all the... Sarah Fenske, folks can go back and check. Now, I didn't play any reports about Maxwell Berry, the white man on the plane who had to be duct taped to the seat. But, oh, man, Gus T. has been talking, writing about, I posted it online, about Maxwell Berry all week long. And, in fact, I have been pointing out, I think, caller in Florida, I think he used the term unruly airline passenger, unruly airline behavior. Gus T. And Cal's listeners, we have been pointing this out for about a month. I think there was a brief period, maybe it was in the when we were in the Seattle heat wave, when I was delusionally thinking about maybe flying somewhere or encouraging other people to, yes, you could come to Seattle and visit. It's so wonderful this summer. All it took was about three reports of saying, oh, wait a minute, are they doing this on the plane all the time? Oh, yep. Never mind. Like, never mind. The Rona is still rolling and all the rest of it. I made up the hashtag, FFTY. Have to explain that later, but that's just what I've been attaching because there have been so many of these, and exactly what he said, individuals classified as white, and it's not even just one, it's been whole mobs. In fact, so we posted this, Maxwell Berry. This is the fella, he had to be detained in Sunshine State of Florida. He's groping flight attendants and under the sobriety would be best. So they duct tape him. They have to get off land. He's been charged, booked, all that, blah, blah, blah. It's been so many of these. It was Cal's listener. She reported it was a class in North Carolina, a class. They were going, I think, to the Bahamas or somewhere in the Caribbean. I'm not going to wear a mask. I just graduated. You're not going to tell me what I'm grown. I'm 18 years old. Get out of here. So they wig out. They have to kick all of them off. It's like 20, 25 up. It's a mob of all these dudes that were going for this. They apparently do this trip every year. That was one. Let me see. It's been a bunch of these. In fact, it got so bad, CNN reported just a couple days ago the Australian Olympic team, not all of them, but a segment of the Australian Olympic team just a few days ago, they're leaving Japan to go home. Sobriety would be best. Someone under the influence, they go in, vomit in the bathroom. Things are so bad that they've broken this restroom, saying they got one less lavatory for the flight. And then they come back and are loud and belligerent on the plane. They got a sanction of some sort from the Olympic Committee about this. And I'm like, these are the Olympians? This is how you lead the Olympics? Like, acted FFTY. And exactly as he said, it's generally been individuals. In fact, every time it's been individuals who would be classified as white. Every time, not one time have I seen it. In fact, the one time it was just today, I saw a video. It was black people, two black males, black male privilege, were going to be kicked off of a flight. I have to see if I can pull up the article to see what the infraction was, because apparently this was so ridiculous that the passengers mutinied. That's how I can find it. Like, it was so ridiculous, the passengers mutinied. And they allowed them to go ahead and stay on the plane. Yes. Okay. Video film of mutiny by passengers at the unfair removal of two black men from flight. This is from businessinsider.com. Passengers on an EasyJet flight reportedly staged a mutiny to stop the airline from unfairly, that word, removing two black men from the flight. The airline reportedly attempted to remove the two men for huffing at a member of the crew when they were asked to put their shoes on for takeoff. I have no idea what huffing means. If anybody wants to let me know what huffing means, and in this context, huffing at a crew member after they've, you know, asked you to put your shoes on, I guess. Incidentally, I didn't know that that was a rule. I've never had them come around and investigate to make sure everybody has their footies on, shoes on, until the plane is actually in the air, but still learning. The incident took place on a flight from London Gatwick Airport to Malaga in Spain, and the passenger, Luke Gale, posted a video on Twitter. Anyway, but yeah, it says that the cabin crew got upset, told them to sit back down, and it got so bad that they allowed these black males to stay on the flight. But anyway, this is the only incident that I've seen where it was some individuals who are not white. All the other folks have been pale and unruly. So, and in fact, many of the incidents, it hasn't been one person being unruly. It's been a whole mob of people being unruly. Very unsafe year, 2021, for a variety of reasons. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I know we did have quite a bit of sabotage, even more people reporting sabotage about their efforts to either dial in or call in. So usual suspects. Hopefully that means the content is somewhat constructive. Let us know if you have thoughts or what have you. Again, we're not for spectators for this particular broadcast. Check Black Talk Radio Network and Facebook for updates about programs for the upcoming week. At minimum, we should be here on Thursday for Woody Allen's autobiography, Apropos of Nothing. I am anxiously waiting to see how he describes this whole romance of his life, tragic arrangement, insert cowbell. But I don't think that's like at the beginning of the book. I think it takes a little while to get to all of that. So we might have to wait like a week to get to the really interesting part, what I think is going to be the crux of the whole book. So, but we are in, if you are with us on the book club, the documentary film Allen vs. Pharaoh might be worth a view. It racism, white supremacy will be there explicitly in the film. It's recent. It just came out, I think like March of this year, and there were lots of articles written about it and all that. That's how I wanted to read this book, because they quote from it in the documentary. So you'll recognize parts of it, I guess, as we get to them. If you watch the film, it's four parts. It will definitely hold your interest, especially if you're with us for the book. Even if you're not, it will hold your interest. And white, I mean, it's flagrantly in it, not just, you know, tragic arrangement and all that, but I mean flagrant and in so many ways, and even some black male privilege. I would definitely recommend folks to watch it. Might even be one that you could recommend for people that are more confused about racism, white supremacy, because it's not like a proselytizing. White supremacy, racism isn't the lead. It'll be child rape, or, you know, however you want to think of it. Anyway, number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. And again, we did have a listener. She dialed in or wrote in for the broadcast yesterday. I think retired firefighter responded, or at least one other person, but and wanted to know if she's going to be given this assignment, give a lecture talking about obesity, nutrition. Not going to be financially compensated, but she will be given access to the Yale Library. She can add this to her resume. Would you do this? No financial compensation, or would you decline? You got other things to do with your time. It's supposed to be 45 minutes, so you can share a thought on that one if you would, and why or why not. That would be grand. If folks are spectating, don't have anything to share, we will wrap things up in about 10-15 minutes or so, maybe 10. If folks are just spectating, maybe they're off watching the conclusion of the Olympics. I know we had, I think it was our caller in Georgia. She was talking about the Olympics and saying that she normally will try to watch them every 4 years or so and get some enjoyment. And I said indulge because it doesn't come around that often. And, you know, as we have seen, lots of things can happen. The whole world could look drastically different in 4 years. So, you know, take advantage if you can do so constructively. But my one observation, and I haven't even seen very much of the Olympics, like I've seen very little. And I normally try to watch at least, you know, a few events, like if the Williams sisters are playing, I want to watch them or, you know, other things. Track and field, I love Allison Felix, like, whew, beautiful. But I haven't watched very much this all. But one thing that I've noted, it pulls you in all that jingoism and white supremacy, racism, so-called countries. I'll end up feeling like, oh, yeah, let's root, hope the U.S. is going to win. It's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, what is going on? Replace white supremacy with justice. But just the inertia, because they have all the music and it's, you know, you have all these folks. They worked all hard to get to this point and everything. They've invested so much in it. That's why so many people were upset for Sha'Carri Richardson, the black female who was not able to compete. Said she failed the drug test with marijuana and all that. Like, they worked so hard to get Allison Felix. You know, she worked so hard and sacrificed time being a mom and everything. And you want to see them do well, get to see some black people that successful and all the rest. But I mean, I am not rooting, like, what is the medal count? Are we kicking their tail? Yeah, go you. Come on, replace white supremacy with justice immediately. And incidentally, there was one other Olympic, since I did get to watch a very tiny bit, and this will go all the way back to the sound test. So racist man, racist woman, racist child, they really the metaphor, they covered all of their bases this week. I want to make it very clear. I am in no way trying to criticize another victim of white supremacy, this young lady, Miss Saunders, who Raven Saunders, who is the, what do they call it? They do the woman shot put. That's it. The shot put. I was trying to think of what it was. Where she medaled. Fantastic. Just said she, I'm sure she invested hours and hours of her youth to get to this moment. But again, they make the big pull to promote number one on both fronts as the Hulk. And then she also is going to represent the LGBTQ black people again, put them front and center both ways as promoting LGBTQ issues, and then they're the homophobes, especially black males, the homophobes, always Isaiah Washington, always, and the rappers, all of them, not just the baby, it's all of them. But number one, or I already said one, with the sexual confusion component of it, and then they come with, I'm just looking at this report from Reuters, athletics Hulk Saunders smashes her limits to Tokyo silver. Hulk Saunders. Again, this is not a critique. In fact, this is the same thing that I pointed out with those names. I'm in Seattle. I was here when the Seahawks won the Super Bowl, and I was on the program saying, man, Marshawn Lynch is beast mode. I said the same thing with the NBA Finals this year. Giannis Antetokounmpo, the freak. Same thing in my, all three of those. The Hulk, and the Hulk, even the character, is a male. Why are we attaching a male character's name to a female? Now, that's, oh my gosh, get with it. It's 2021, and we're not about all that, and gender is fluid, and it's not. Contempt for gender, and then you put black people right up front, all of everything. So we got a whole big list just from this week alone. DaBaby and Lil Nas X and Hulk Saunders, Alphonso Davies. We got a whole list all out in front. Black people, yes, sexual confusion, even at the Olympics. So yeah, again, watch the Olympics, enjoy it. But I mean, the racism, white supremacy will be prominent there as well. How could it not be? It is the dominant force on the planet. Let's see. The other folks who dialed in, if we've missed you totally.
May I be heard?
Our black female caller in South Carolina by way of New York. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, thank you. Good evening, Gus, to the callers and listeners. I'll try to be brief. For the female person who has to, who's given the speech regarding health and nutrition and will have access to the Yale Library, and but she's not being compensated for her time and effort, I just wanted to chime in on that. And I thought that maybe in addition to the access to the library, she should have access to significant white people. That's going to increase her nickels exponentially, you know, as a victim of racism, T.I. would say. That's what I think. And also, regarding the beach property in Brooklyn, I'm from New York, and I've been in South Carolina for about 5 years. And I think the reports that one of the ways that they were going to keep away the riffraff was to use alternate side of the street parking. And that's something that's generally used for cleaning. Like, you have to park your car on one side of the street. So you're allowed to park your car on one side of the street, and while the street cleaners clean that side, you know, certain days of the week at certain times, and then vice versa. So that's interesting. But I know that when I was in New York for a good stretch of Coney Island, which is also in that beach area, the amusement park, and Coney Island, going up to the Rockaways, that there were meters. So I guess that's not working, but the real estate game in New York is crazy, so I can understand them wanting to use whatever tactics that they can to keep black people out. Incidentally, there are some black people that live in some of those high rises there, but they've been there since the year one. So, you know, some of us are there. With regard to Letitia James, the attorney general in New York, who has done her work with Cuomo and his issues. I remember when she was on the city council, so now she's attorney general, but I still don't think that she's in charge, but I could be wrong about that. I just wanted to give a field report. I watch my city council meetings, local city council zoning meetings on YouTube. I encourage anybody who wants to know anything that's going on in their neighborhood, because we are in the COVID Zoom era, to utilize YouTube to see what's going on, because these people are not in office. Some of them are doing Zoom meetings that have to, and we have to know about it, but we can't go there physically, so they're doing a lot of Zoom meetings. So if you want to know what's going on in your neighborhood, what the plans are with regard to your particular living plantation and how they decide they want to divvy it up and who's going to be in charge, or quote-unquote they're going to put over that particular project, that's a good way to use it. Here in South Carolina, of course, everything is back to, almost back to, quote-unquote, normal, as fantasy would have it. So they are actually meeting behind 10 pieces of plexiglass and bottles, huge bottles of hand sanitizers and masks, and spread out all over whatever room to resume their meetings. So I was looking at a local zoning meeting on YouTube, and I noticed that in the meeting that there were, like, all black women in the audience, you know, 6 feet apart with their masks on and what have you. And they were speaking about 369 residential place that they were going to put in an area on the plantation known as Columbia, South Carolina. 369 homes that they were going to build. They're talking about the average square feet of the home, how far they're going to be apart, which particular land lot that they're using to put the homes in, and what have you. And then they, you know, all the little details, you know, the developers weren't there, because developers are never at these meetings. Okay, it's always the residents and the people from the local government, and somebody that they may have as a spokesperson who works with the local government, who actually lives in the neighborhood. That's, you know, that's the ringer right there. So they're talking about this meeting and these homes and the size of them, and They asked for there were anybody who had questions who emailed them in, you know, just as you do. And, you know, so somebody said the secretary was, no, no questions. Do we have any calls? So secretary said, no, no calls. Okay, meeting is adjourned. As this program was played into black, every black person in that meeting looked at each other like, what the hell just happened? What happened? We don't understand what just happened. And it was faded to black, and I saw one black woman's hand go up. And then the seal came on as if the meeting was over, but I looked at the meeting, and I said, there's 25 more minutes left. What happened was that they totally ignored the women who were there. And I'm like, what did you think that they were there for, to observe this and not have questions about this? They totally adjourned the meeting. Then they opened it back up. And, oh, we're opening back up the meeting to take questions from the audience. Myself, I have never seen anything like this. Well, these women had questions like, okay, so you're putting 360-something homes in here. Are you building another school? Because these are residential homes. I'm quite sure these people are having families and they're having children. And we are already on top of each other. Another woman had a question. Has anybody done a traffic study? Because this area was hit by the flood really, really bad in 2015, and they haven't repaired our roads yet. So you have this big 18-wheeler that's always coming down here and making U-turns in our yard because they get lost trying to get to, listen to this, a brewery close by that they put in the neighborhood, right? So another woman said, I have children. Have you done a traffic study with, you know, because you're going to be building so close to our homes. My parents have been there for 40 years. We live there as a family. I mean, these were major, major concerns. At the end of everything that they said, this racist suspect council member said, well, thank you so much. We'll take your concerns into consideration, and we thank you for your input. And that was the end of that. So I think that everybody should tune into these meetings to see exactly how we are being overdeveloped in our neighborhoods, and how that we're just not being heard. Not being heard. Doesn't matter if you show up. They'll act like, you know, well, we're here for the people in email and for the people who called in. And I've seen several of these meetings go this exact same way. But I just noticed that when there are racist suspects in there, there may be an actual city council leader running for an office at the meeting. And that's all I have, Gus. And thank you for letting me share. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, black female caller in South Carolina. Excellent recommendation to, if you have the time, or you don't, you can devote, like after you get off work, you could just devote a small amount of time to, hey, I'll check a lot of those virtual meetings or what have you. Sometimes they'll put them on YouTube, you know, or just they'll have the link where you can check it out, watch it at your leisure, and just see what happens. If you can tune in live, even better. Ask questions. We talk about that all the time, getting better, refining our skill at asking questions. Great opportunity to do so from the comfort of your own home. Now, I'm not surprised about the tackiness. Like they have the meeting and then don't adjourn it and don't even give an opportunity for them to get a hand up for questioning. Yep. Question? Okay. Boop. And then we got to go. Oh, they were. We got. Oh, okay. We'll go back in. Like total tacky, and bravo for them sticking right there. And bam, we got serious questions. The roads. The schools, absolutely. And just that alone sometimes can have an impact. Mr. Fuller has talked about, like, hey, a lot of times racists, they like doing things where they can hustle you, right? Where they can fool you and nobody even cat, like, you figure it's 10 years before you even figure out what happened. Like, they are a little bit more hesitant sometimes to do things when it's we got to come ask questions, and they know who we are, and they're going to be waiting on a response and all that. Sometimes that can slow things down. Like, dang, at least some of them, they're paying attention. Like, they're going to make it a little more difficult for us. As for the beach in New York and lots of places, different strategies to make it difficult. She talked about parking meters. That's what they had before, and now out and out. We just don't allow for parking during specific times of the year, i.e. the summer, peak times when people might want to come visit the beach. Oh, no. nowhere to buy. You're going to have to walk 5 miles and probably pay, you know, $100 per hour if you're going to come and try and find parking at the beach, because we don't have any public parking over here, just for the residents, white people. And that's, and I think one of the other callers mentioned that, how they get through these reports a lot of times talking about the Rona or whatever it is without identifying white people. It will be upper class, wealthy, privileged. It will be lots of different euphemisms as opposed to just saying white people, which, and in fact, I think the caller in Florida, he was saying the term unvaccinated. The report that we heard about the global requests that, hey, and that was another one where they said wealthy nations. Now, that's one like, ooh, replace wealthy nations with mostly white people, because all of these so-called wealthy nations like the U.S., Canada, the U.K., Germany, predominantly white populations. And in all of those areas, it's the same skew that they've reported, that it's mostly white people who've been vaccinated. We heard that today, Boston, New York, exactly that. So that report, it should be countries, predominantly white countries, and then predominantly white people in these predominantly white countries, or the verb they used was hogging the vaccines. Now, that is a way to process and think about COVID. That's why I said, you think unvaccinated, they're talking about non-white people. And then they started breaking it down. Indonesia and the Philippines and all these different. Nigeria is about to have 1 billion people. 2,100. 2,100, they're projected to have 1 billion people from UNESCO. And they can't get a vaccine in Nigeria. Lots of dark people there. Not a coincidence, and not a coincidence even to, let's make sure that we do not identify that it's white people who are the ones overwhelmingly who are vaccinated. Unvaccinated equals not white. And in fact, did you, when they were talking about New York, and they said, man, this seems like it might be a policy, if the vaccine passport, as they're calling it, this seems like it might be a policy that will make it hard on the unvaccinated. Replace that with non-white people. They even had another one. This was, I posted this on social media earlier this week after Maxwell Berry. They said unvaccinated people need to bear the burden. This was in The Atlantic just a couple days ago. You have to read the article. For what does that mean exactly? Bear the burden? Like what? And then there was, let me give one more, then we'll double check. Let's see. The other one was, amid a global health crisis, people who defy public health guidance are not and do not deserve to be a protected class. Talking about the unvaccinated non-white people. And that's the way that they talk about non-white people, too. They do not deserve to be a protected class, affirmative action, and all this nonsense. Any other comments, questions, folks want to make sure they share. Thank you kindly as well, our black female in South Carolina, responding to the request from our listener. Any other comments, observations, folks want to share last few minutes or so on the broadcast? Folks getting their thoughts, we'll double check once more. I mentioned the victim of white supremacy, Raven Saunders, where she's nicknamed Hulk, the like after the comic book character or movie character, whichever. This is in the BBC. They report Raven Saunders, what the Olympians X protest means to her. And you get in trouble for all those protests on the podium, right? We know that many, many years. So they write, as the medalists posed for photos on Sunday, Saunders raised her arms and crossed them into an X shape. She said it represented the intersection of where all people who are oppressed meet. Again, we're not saying racism, white supremacy, all people who are oppressed. Victims guaranteed qualified But the same thing that we heard from Kevin Powell way back at the beginning of the broadcast, as I said, racists have done a phenomenal job confusing us about what? White supremacy racism, not oppression, not intersectionalism and sexism and homophobia. And we got to talk about white supremacy racism. Nothing like it. No comparison. Even Angie Schmidt did that. Bring up all the gay people and LGBTQ and blah, blah, blah. White supremacy racism. Continuing. The 25-year-old who is black, gay, and has spoken frankly about her struggles with depression said she wanted to be me to not apologize. After competing, she said she aimed to give light to people all around the world who are fighting and don't have the platform to speak up for themselves. I'm part of a lot of communities, added Saunders, who twerked in celebration after her final shot put throw. Again, the only, even that right there is, you know, victims guaranteed qualified, but I think I already said today, there's one community, the white community. They've even fooled us with that word. I don't think you would have to be afraid to come out and just be who you are without feeling like you have to apologize and all the rest if we had a community. Incidentally, even when she said about twerking afterwards, I remember 2012, I already mentioned the Williams sisters. Serena Williams got in trouble for twerking in London. I remember that. Watched it. They were furious about it. Like, what decorum? They were talking all about decorum then. Like, you are supposed to deport yourself with class. This is the Olympics. You're not back with Snoop Doggy Dogg and Compton and all that. Remember that? Woo. Racism, white supremacy at the Olympics. Incidentally, since I mentioned the Williamses twice, we're about to end. I normally would be no Area 8, no movies, but I saw that Will Smith is supposed to be doing a movie biopic on Richard Williams and the Williams family. I was stunned. I don't know when this is supposed to be released, and I'm sure racist white supremacists will find many ways to corrupt and make sure that they do not allow Will Smith to portray like a sterling image of a proud, attempted black father raising these, you know, world-class tennis icons to totally revolutionize not just women's tennis, but women's athletics, period. Athletics, really, period, for the past 30 years. I'm sure they're going to do everything they can to corrupt such a project, but I am excited to see Will Smith portraying Richard Williams on what they call the silver screen. I guess a lot of us will probably have to stream it, you know. Whenever it comes out, it'll probably be the Rona will have shut things down again, but we can stream it on our big screens and what have you at home and check it out, talk about it down the road. Maybe we'll get Dr. Kevorkian on to discuss that at some point when possible. Any other comments folks need to make sure they get in before we get ready to wrap things up? We'll assume folks are all satisfied for the week. Again, check Black Talk Radio Network, Facebook, if you have concerns, questions, upcoming broadcasts, guest suggestions, drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. Stay safe. Like I said, like, man, I have never felt more ever-present personal danger in any year that I can recall than this year. And I mean, all of the time is dangerous in the system of white supremacy, but this year has been acutely dangerous for a variety of reasons. And it seems that way on a pretty wide scale. Even I talked with a black male on a completely different part of the country, and he was using very similar language, saying that I'm not even able to make any plans currently because of the danger and just trying to protect my safety. I just can only take things one day at a time. That's the best I can do. I said, man, that is, whew, that is depressing, demoralizing. But Dr. Welsing, she did tell us to be not discouraged. All of that is a part of the system of white supremacy, and it has been a grueling and terroristic experience in 2021. Hopefully we can all invest some time in self-care and trying to nourish as opposed to being destructive with our health and getting quality rest as best we can, too. That is so important, eating well, getting quality rest as opposed to just being self-destructive when racists are making things especially challenging and difficult for us. All of that said, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. We need really high-functioning brain computers to solve our problems. In addition to being sober, I would say, man, if you're going out, be very alert of your surroundings. If you see folks being hostile and loud, this is not a time to confront strangers verbally. Exit. You never know. There are lots of gun owners. This loud, rowdy person might be armed. They might have an entire armed entourage. If you didn't leave your residence, prepare to kill and or die. Exit. Just trying to be intelligent and preserve life. If you're driving, you're not on the cell phone, just doing the small things we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. And we need our attention. As I said, it's kind of dangerous out there. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. No name calling, no gossiping. We talked about on the program yesterday, just trying to at minimum model black self-respect around other black people. Like, man, that alone can have a huge impact. Just black people consistently, the victims of racism who are around you, they see you referring to other black people by their name, not calling them nicknames and all this other stuff, being as courteous as you can be to other black people consistently. You're not gossiping and what have you, trying to be helpful where you can. Just that alone, modeling constructive black self-respect, can have a significant impact. People are watching you. Be mindful. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.